available in more homes than the Pac-12 Network, we are the Podcast of Champions. Fight! I'm David Woods from Bruin Report Online.
And here he goes, Miles Jack.
And I'm Ryan Abraham from USCFootball.com.
Liner going to try to sneak it ahead. Touchdown, SC!
We are the Podcast of Champions.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Podcast of Champions. I'm David Woods from Bruin Report Online, the UCLA site on the 247 Sports Network.
And I'm Ryan Abraham from USCFootball.com, the USC site on the 247 Sports Network. It's still hard to say. We are the Podcast of Champions. That means we talk about the Pac-12 football. We love to do it. We've been doing it every week, well, almost, for the last 3 years.
And, many weeks in the last three years we have recorded a podcast.
Many weeks, yes. And this is week 13. We're going to recap week 13 today, and we're going to preview the Pac-12 championship game and then get to all of your questions. And there's a lot of them. We got voicemails, we got tweets, we got emails. So it's all cool. If you want to tweet us on the Twitter, Twitter's been really popular the last few days. All this crazy stuff going on at Pac-12 Podcast. Our website, where you can find our old shows, is Pac-12Podcast.com. Our voicemail, 641-715-3900, then extension 734-972. Leave a voicemail. We love to play it. We're going to play three of them today that we haven't even listened to yet. That's how much we love the voicemails.
You shouldn't let them know that, because they're going to try to sneak something in next time.
Yeah.
We shouldn't let them know that.
Yeah. It's just been kind of a crazy day. It's always crazy. You know, Dave, there's all this stuff going on. Like, I didn't have time to, like, even listen to the voicemails yet. Like, as we're on the phone, I'm, like, downloading them onto my little iPad here. Where, you know, and you know, within minutes of us recording this, like, Chip Kelly's press conference just ended. You got firings going on at Arizona State, the team that finished second in the Pac-12 South. Like, a lot of crazy stuff going on, Dave.
Pretty light week, I think, in the Pac-12. I mean, my Thanksgiving was really light and easy. I can't, you know, didn't even think about anything work-related, of course, because, yeah, man, this was crazy. I mean, we're living in a brave new world, man, because UCLA just fired a coach on a Sunday, hired a coach on a Saturday, and pretty much got their first guy, and there was nothing embarrassing about the search. That's new ground for UCLA right there. Completely new ground. It was incredible.
Yeah, that's. I mean, that you got a team like Florida, a program like Florida, like recent national championships, a lot of tradition. Like, they had to go to the third guy. Like, it's not easy. Even if everything works out great, things could fall through, and you just don't get the guy you want. So, UCLA getting like the big dog out there is a pretty big deal for the Pac-12.
Yeah, it's a big deal for the Pac-12. Big deal, obviously, for UCLA. And you know, I think my big takeaway from it, I mean, Chip Kelly, probably the best chance to work out of any UCLA coach, I mean, literally, that they've ever hired, but, like, especially in the last three or four hirings. But even beyond that, I think the level of commitment this showed from UCLA to actually being a big-time football program is probably my bigger takeaway, because whether or not this one works out, they're not trying to hire a Denver Broncos wide receivers coach anymore, or a out of work Baltimore Ravens quarterbacks coach, or, you know, a guy who's sat out a year after failing at two NFL stops and never having coached in college. They're actually hiring a guy who's proven it at the college level, at not just like he can run a winning program, but a program that, you know, competes among the elite. And I think that speaks to maybe UCLA finally turning over a new leaf in terms of commitment to athletics.
Yeah, it's I really think it's a big deal. People on Twitter get mad at me, like, because I cover USC. Like, when USC was looking for a coach a couple years ago, I thought Chip Kelly would be a good idea. Some people agreed. A bunch of people did not. They're like, no way. Why would you want that guy? And blah, blah, blah. But my personal opinion is I think he's going to do really well in college. Obviously, we're going to, you know, kind of wait and see. But at the very least, the Pac-12 had so many things that were down about the Pac-12 this year. Not going to make the playoff. There's, you know, the game times and all that kind of crap, that, you know, ESPN trolling, and there's so much bad going on. For a Pac-12 team to be able to kind of take this away from an SEC team, I think it brings a little bit, you know, the level of relevance. higher in the entire conference. We saw like a kind of coaching resurgence in like 2012. Some of those guys are starting to be fired now, but you know, this could be another one. You got Willie Taggart. We'll see what, you know, Justin Wilcox is able to do. Chip Kelly. I mean, maybe an Arizona State brings in like a Kevin Sumlin. Like, this could be like part two, 2.0 of the coaching resurgence in the Pac-12. And you got to have them. Like, the SEC, I think they probably have the best athletes, but I don't think they have the best coaches. And if you can at least get the best coaches in the Pac-12, I think it would help a lot.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's been a little bit of the narrative. I think a large part of the narrative was kind of subsumed by everything that then happened on Sunday with, you know, the craziness at Tennessee and ASU firing Todd Graham. But yeah, I mean, UCLA landing Chip Kelly, I mean, that does kind of send shockwaves through the whole ecosystem of college football, because I think a lot of people who are casual observers couldn't possibly fathom a reason why somebody would pick UCLA over Florida. And I think objectively, I think that's probably a valid take. Florida's probably, like, if you're just looking for certain factors, it's probably a better job, just from history and all that kind of stuff. But UCLA obviously has a ton of potential, as we've talked about here. And Chip Kelly apparently saw some of that. But yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see if ASU can now land somebody who's really good, and if that does lead to kind of a 2012-esque resurgence in Pac-12 coaching, or even maybe beyond that.
Two potential programs, UCLA and Arizona State. Arizona State, people call a sleeping giant. I think you called it a sleeping very tall guy on Twitter, which is funny. Before we kind of jump, I want to talk about Arizona State, but before we jump into that, listening to the Chip Kelly press conference, anything kind of stand out for you? Because it literally just ended, like, you know, within a half an hour of us starting to record the show.
Nothing. I mean, I thought for a press conference, I thought he nailed it. But, you know, we've at UCLA, we've watched a lot of guys win a press conference and then not do a whole lot. And I thought he definitely won that press conference, whatever that means. He said some things that were a little bit interesting. He talked a lot about trying to fit scheme to players, which, you know, again, it's a talking point, but that's something that UCLA coaches in the past have really struggled to do. They'll try to just make their scheme happen regardless of the personnel. So I thought that was good, good for UCLA to hear from Chip Kelly. But for the most part, I just thought he sounded good. He sounded really, really eager to start. But I have a hard time taking too much away from press conferences, except when they're very weird. And that's probably a good transition into ASU, which had a very, very strange press conference from Ray Davidson announcing the Todd Graham firing yesterday.
It was kind of strange. And, you know, saying that one game doesn't matter all that much, you know, obviously ASU won the Territorial Cup, but ASU did finish second in the Pac-12 South, and he just poo-pooed that like it was nothing. Like, he said the Pac-12 South are like terrible or something. It didn't matter. I mean, they got a huge win against Washington. You know, they beat Utah. Certainly the win against Arizona, where they were losing, and it looked like for them to have their backs against the wall and then fight back in that game, you know, even though Khalil Tate got hurt. But, you know, I thought there were some positive things there. It just seemed like his mind was made up kind of heading into that. And, you know, if you look at our rankings, like, we have Arizona State in the top half, spoiler alert, of the power rankings. It's not like the 10th or 11th best team in the conference. Like, it's still a top half team. So there's a lot of guys coming back for that squad. I think it's going to be a really good job for somebody. Maybe it's a sleeping really tall guy, like Dave said. Maybe it's a sleeping giant. I don't know. But bringing a big name like that, and it kind of puts the entire Pac-12 South on notice, because this is a team that already finished second.
Yeah, and so my take on Arizona State as a job is basically this. Like, and we talked about this a few weeks ago, like every other job in the Pac-12, if you get a right coach in terms of, like, super elite guy, like, say you luck into Urban Meyer when he's young, or you get, you know, you land Chip Kelly or whatever, or you get, you know, Nick Saban when he's relatively young, you can win huge there, absolutely, if you get an elite coach. But I think if you have a good coach there, it's still one of those jobs where there's going to be cycles. Like, I don't think it's and if I'm denigrating Arizona State here, I don't mean to, because I think it's a really good job in the Pac-12, but it doesn't have the recruiting base in terms of, you know, being in LA, essentially, because I think USC and UCLA probably have that recruiting base, or have the kind of academic national base that Stanford does, or that weird brand that Oregon built. It doesn't quite have that, and maybe it could build, but it doesn't have that right now. And so I think it is prone to these cyclical lulls, like how a lot of schools are. You build up when you have, you know, a good group of juniors and seniors. That's when you make your run, you win a division, compete for the conference. Basically, you know, once every 3 or 4 years, you're really, you know, in that competition. And then you have lulls. And I think Arizona State just went through a lull that's kind of cyclical. They had a really good coach in Todd Graham. I mean, I think we talked about it 2 years ago, and they hit a lull soon after that. But we talked about Todd Graham as being potentially one of the top four coaches in the league at that time. I mean, we were talking about him as potentially one of the best two. And he didn't suddenly, you know, forget how to coach in the last, you know, whatever. And I just thought it was interesting with the way this year finished, with finishing second in the league and clearly setting up for what should be a really good year next year. They fired him, and I mean, maybe the plan is under wraps, but it seemed like the messaging from their athletic director was just so weird. Potentially wants the next coach to keep the offensive and defensive coordinators.
Bizarre.
Just and maintain the culture, but Todd Graham built that culture. So I just thought it was all very strange. I mean, we joked about it on the podcast a few times that Arizona State was going to fire him this year and the whole thing. But honestly, given the way this year turned out, given the fact that they beat Arizona in this final game, given just kind of the makeup of that squad for next year, I mean, the more I looked at it, the more I thought it was a really baffling decision to fire him.
Yeah, I was watching like the Pac-12 Sports Report or the post-game thing, and Lincoln Kennedy, one of the analysts on there, they were talking about who should be the coach of the year. He said Todd Graham, like, you know?
Yeah.
Like, that's insane. Like, he could have been the coach of the year.
They were picked to go, like, 3-9 this year or 4-8. I mean, it wasn't like this was expected to be a 7-5 second in the Pac-12 South. And, yeah, the Pac-12 is a little bit down, but not as down as the athletic director made it sound. I mean, they went 6-3 in a major Power 5 conference. That has to count for something.
Yeah, apparently not. So that was one of those things where they just had a decision. The rumors kind of came out right away that it was going to be Kevin Sumlin. Like within an hour of him being fired, I think Billy Lucci, who does TexAgs, which is like the biggest Texas A&M site, he's like a dude that's really, like, really well connected there. Said it was Sumlin was going to go to Arizona State. Then our buddy Bruce Feldman came out and said, like, no, that's not happening. So it sounds like, you know, it could happen, but it was it looked like it could have happened right away.
Yeah. And I don't know if that would, I mean, it doesn't sound like that's imminent at this point. Like, no. I was reading on Twitter from a few different people that, yeah, he's in the mix, but he's not even necessarily the top candidate right now. So there seems to be, basically my point here is there seems to be a lot of confusion about it. And if you're going to make the move to fire a guy who just went 7-5 and 6-3 in conference, you better have a really clear-cut plan for what you're doing. And at least at this juncture, it doesn't, I mean, it doesn't necessarily look that way. Obviously, we're only a day in, so, I mean, a lot can still happen. But,
right.
I mean, if you're, that list of candidates that came out, which was, I think, Kevin Sumlin, Derek Mason, and Pep Hamilton, that initial list that came out, and then I think Bruce added to it a little bit with Jed Fish and a couple other names. But, I mean, if that's your list and you just fired a guy who, you know, was 60% winning percentage in the Pac-12. I mean, I think Arizona State's winningest coach since Frank Kush. You might be doing it wrong.
Yeah, and that kind of day where you're talking like Pep Hamilton and who was the other like and
Derek Mason, the Vanderbilt coach.
Yeah, so that's like you have like a sizzling like T-bone steak or something, and then like, you know, old Brussels sprouts and some and like parsley, like that. Like obviously Kevin Sumlin's the winner there. Like what, you know, what are you thinking? But I don't know. It's kind of baffling. It wasn't his guy. So you know, he was around for 4 years, but if you looked at the record of head coaches in the Pac-12 South, he had the best record over the last, whatever, 5-6 years or 5 years or whatever it was. USC's had a better record overall, but three different head coaches. As far as one single head coach, Todd Graham had the best record. So I don't know.
Yeah. I wonder how much of it was arms race, just seeing what UCLA did to another coach who'd had like, I mean, again, he won, I think about 60% of his games at UCLA, landing Chip Kelly. Maybe, I don't know, maybe that influenced the decision. I can't imagine it would, since he seemed pretty dead set on firing him for weeks now, but yeah, peculiar.
Peculiar stuff. All right. Well, that was our breaking news. We did. I just got in my email box. I want to read off the Pac-12 players of the week. I think I got them all right this week. It's not that I get them right. We all vote. You know, we vote. Do you have any guess on the offensive one?
No.
He wears, not off the top of my wears head. Purple, scored four touchdowns.
Oh, okay.
Miles Gaskin. He did. Yeah, not Jake Browning. He threw
not four. Jake Browning. I was going to throw out the noodle arm. That would have been funny.
So Miles Gaskin, yeah, he had four touchdowns, so that's pretty good, I guess. Kenny Young for UCLA got the defensive player of the week. He had a lot
of people counting stats and not watching football games.
That was 15 tackles. That's a lot. He had a fumble recovery too. Mm-hmm. Special teams. I don't usually vote for punters, but Jake Bailey for Stanford had five punts that were over 50 yards, and he had a 65-yard, like a career-long one. So he had seven times, averaged over 50 yards a punt. So pretty good for that group of guys. And a couple other notes I have before we jump into week 13 and our picks. We got to talk about those. So the Pac-12 has nine bowl eligible teams. So there's seven, you know, tie-in games. So there's going to be two that are kind of like at large. The closest. So this past weekend was rivalry games. They were all kind of blowouts. So the closest one was 12 points of the rivalry game. So that's not the greatest week, you know, weekend of rivalry games. And five Pac-12 teams, Dave, were undefeated at home. So the three powers in the North, Washington State, and Stanford, all undefeated at home. And then USC and UCLA in the South. But only two teams had winning records on the road. You want to guess which two?
USC.
That's one of them, yes.
And Washington?
Yeah, very good. Those are the two teams.
Washington was just barely, though, right?
Let me look at their thing. They had... Who did they... So they lost two games. They lost to... where is it at? On the road to Arizona State and on the road at Stanford. So, yeah. So they were... what did they have? They had one, two, three. So they had five road games. So they were 3-2 on the road.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
And then I do feel bad for the our producer friends over at the Pac-12 Network, because if you watch that sometimes, and there's always like those coaching little drops or whatever. They're like, "This is Todd Graham, and you're watching the Pac-12 Network." As they kind of go, you know, three of them are down, so there's like fewer guys in the rotation that they can kind of pick from when they're doing stuff. So like, if you're doing like, you know, Pac-12 Network Oregon, like half of your coaching drops are like gone now. So
Yeah, tough life when you have to it's just David Shaw just talking over and over and over again. He's the safest coach in the Pac-12,
right?
Him or Peterson. Yeah,
they're like, yeah, those guys aren't going anywhere. Okay, so quick recap on our picks since this is our last like full week. Dave, I'm looking, you've had a rough like stretch, so you had
been a rough 3 or 4 weeks here.
You have a losing record 4 of the last 5 weeks. So your commanding lead, pretty much ever since we had Kyle on, it's kind of went downhill. So maybe you can blame Kyle for that.
Blame the Bonagura curse.
Yeah. So you went 2-4. I went 3-3. So it wasn't like a great, but because we tied. So the Utah game, which I was really worried about, since I heard like right before the stupid. They announced the starting quarterback's not going to play, like, right before the game. Like, what? Uh-huh. Really? So Huntley didn't play. But it didn't matter because Troy Williams played well. We'll get into that later. But we both finished 46-44 against the spread through the regular season. So not great. Two games above 500. We were well above 500 last year. But at least we both finished above 500, and at least I came back and tied you.
Hey, so, it's not over yet. It's not over.
No. But, yeah, I feel good. Like, the regular season, I feel pretty good about. After you had this commanding lead.
Enjoy those regular season championships. I'm here to talk about the postseason. All right.
Nice. All right. Well, you ready for our
Pac-12 Roundup?
Born ready.
You're born ready? Okay. So pretty much securing their spot at number 12 for perpetuity? No, I'm not going to say that. We have
Oregon State Beavers.
And they were on the road taking on
Oregon Ducks.
Oh my God, this game. Oregon beat Oregon State 69-10.
What?
Oregon had 52 points at halftime. 52 points.
It was 52-7 at the half.
And it was like they had like 450 yards of offense at halftime. Like this was over. I mean, I don't even want to say it was over at halftime. This was over after like 20 minutes or so. Oregon State clearly was ready for the season to be over about 3 weeks ago. Whatever little boost they got from Corey Hall being named the interim, that dissipated rapidly before like I even really noticed. But they were, I mean, this was such an ugly, horrific beatdown. And I mean, Oregon State beat Oregon last year in the Civil War. So to come back and do this to them, beat them by 59 points, I mean, in a rivalry game, that is horrific. Oregon did everything they wanted to do. They ran the ball. Justin Herbert played well. They locked him down defensively. I mean, we've talked about it a bunch. If Justin Herbert's healthy this entire year, this is probably a 9-3 team at worst, and maybe even a 10-2 team. But as it stands, I think they're set up for a big year next year. And I know we keep hearing like vague rumors about Willie Taggart potentially being a candidate at various jobs. I happen to think that's just agent posturing. I think he might be another Jimmy Sexton client. But there whatever are. The case,
everybody's
I think they're
a Jimmy
poised
Sexton
for
client.
Everyone. Yeah. Everyone in the world besides Chip Kelly is a Jimmy Sexton client. I happen to think they're going to be really good next year. And this certainly propels them into bowl season and then the offseason on a very high note.
Yeah, I'll pat myself on the back. I kind of figured out the Corey Hall effect was like dying after a couple weeks, and which was good. I mean, it was really good to start, but then it kind of was going downhill. Didn't expect it to go this far downhill, but whatever the spread was, what did we have the spread of this one? The spread was
26. Oregon minus 26.
Yeah.
So Oregon doubled it.
Yeah,
which
and we
is
were
hard
like,
to do on a 26-pointer.
Yeah. We were. But we were all over this. We're like, yes, for sure. I didn't get to watch a second of this game live, and then I was like, I'm not going to, you know. So I would go back and watch parts of it. But this was actually the most points scored by anybody in this series, which, you know, you can imagine. That's a lot of points. Oregon ended up with 577 yards, 28 first downs. The Ducks defense held the Beavers to 98 yards rushing in the game. Royce Freeman, he ends up with 60 rushing touchdowns, so that's a Pac-12 record. He had 122 yards. I think it was 55-7, Dave, if you're watching, and Oregon gets like a pick six. Like stuff they were just like throwing in that you just didn't need, like this extra seasoning that you just this recipe didn't need that. You know, like it's 55 like it's 55-7. You don't need a pick six in there. The trash talking though was kind of interesting. I don't know if you saw some of this kind of before the game. But Corey Hall was talking about last year, you had mentioned that Oregon State had won. It was kind of raining, and he had made some comment about he looked over and saw that the Oregon players were wearing raincoats, and they knew they had it at that point. That really upset. Willie Taggart talked about it afterwards, the players. And I feel bad. And then Corey Hall, I think Oregon State brass like fired everybody else. Like it's only Corey Hall there is left right now. But that kind of trash talking and stuff. Those guys relished it. Like, I don't know what you feel about bulletin board material, but those guys embraced it. They were talking about, hey, it's raining touchdowns, instead of raining, you know, so they really used it to their advantage.
Yeah. I mean, I think trash talk, football's a really emotional game on the field. So I think the trash talk element definitely plays a role. And I think if you're Oregon State, you got to be prepared to back that stuff up when you start doing that. I mean, they gathered around the O at the middle of the field and yelled, you know, some F the Ducks or something like that.
Ooh.
And then did you see after the game that Oregon players, they wore their like raincoats or whatever for the handshake or something like that? I mean, it was just all like very funny and fun. You know, that's part of the fun of a rivalry. I mean, it's not fun. Watching a 59-point beatdown, but these sorts of things that happen, I mean, it just adds to the lore and the like just the story of it all. You know, when an interim coach is talking mess and then Oregon comes back and beats him by 59 points after losing last year, I mean, it's just you know, I think that adds to the fun and the flavor.
Yeah, props to Corey Hall for the first couple of weeks, but just kind of was unsustainable, and then just things went downhill, and that's going to be tough. You know, we've heard like Bo Baldwin, maybe, you know, the Cal offensive coordinator, former Eastern Washington head coach. You know, I think there's some good names, but will they take it? I'm really curious to kind of see what happens there. But they need to change the call. They need to do something different because it was not pretty. 1-11. You're not going to win over a lot of people. All right. Should we move on?
Please.
All right. Let's go. So this one, we got another rivalry game. This one, our number 11 team.
Colorado Buffaloes.
They were also on the road taking on
Utah Utes.
Yeah, so this was another. I mean, there were a lot of hideous games in the Pac-12 this week, and this was another one of them. It was a laugher again, really early. Utah had a 28-0 lead at halftime. Colorado just couldn't get anything done offensively. They missed a field goal early, but they also. I mean, I think their first four drives, they had a missed field goal in there, but three and out, four and out, three and out, and their other three of their first four drives. And in that time, Utah poured 21 points on them. And Utah's defense has had its issues this year, but it's not the kind of team and not the kind of coach that you're going to come back from a 21-point deficit on. It's just it's hard to do that against a well-coached team, and Utah certainly is that. Colorado just seemed weird all year.
Yes.
Like they weren't quite in it. Their offense was never even close to what everyone thought it might be at the beginning of the year. Defensively, they started somewhat strong, but as the season wore on, their rush defense got really bad. Honestly, after the coaching job Mike McIntyre did the previous year, this didn't look like a super motivated team all year to me. It just looked a little off all season long, and the fact that they were able to get nothing done offensively, Steven Montez once again had a pretty just ugly day, and he looked so good last year. All of that, just funky year for Colorado, but you got to give credit to Utah. I was really happy that Troy Williams played a great game.
Yes.
in his final game. I mean, that was so cool to see. Utah gets to bowl eligibility in a year where they had their starting quarterback who's going to be a star down the road, Tyler Huntley, dinged up for several games. I thought this was a nice way to cap their season because they never, you know, kind of showed that they never really quit on the season. And I think that is a testament to their coaching and turning into a pretty decent running team by the end of the year, I think, is a pretty solid harbinger for the future for them.
Yeah, this is the only one we did differently. So I picked Utah -10.5, and you took Colorado. I was a little worried when I hear it right before the game, and I was out like at a party, and I'm like, crap, Tyler Huntley's not playing. Like, I was almost going to text you, like, hey, can I change my pick? Which obviously you would have said yes. I think I was still worried, and it was like 20-0. I didn't even realize like that was going on. I was like, oh, they're fine. Don't worry about it. What was up with the helmets for Utah, though? Did you see those? Like the U fingers? Like it's like fingers on the side of their heads. Did you see that?
Yeah, I didn't know what that was.
No clue.
No idea.
I was just like, what? So, I mean, if you look at the back of the helmet, it's like someone's making like a U with their fingers. But like basically you look on the side of the helmet, it looked like these guys with fingers on there. Here's what's interesting. So Colorado was coming off a bye, and they sucked, right? They looked like crap. You know, Washington State came off a bye. We'll talk about them later. They did not look good. This is a November bye. So five Pac-12 teams had November byes. Cal, week 11, they had a bye. They end up losing. Oregon had a week 11 bye. They end up winning. So you know, three of the four teams that had November byes so far, we'll see with USC in the championship game, lost after their bye weeks. And the two teams this week looked like absolute dog crap. I don't know if you knew that.
Yeah, and I wonder if some of that is just you get in a rhythm when you start playing game after game after game, and then breaking up that rhythm is maybe more of a negative effect than even getting a little bit healthier, a little bit more rested is a positive effect. And this is purely anecdotal, but when I'm thinking about bye weeks, it seems like teams generally do better when they have like that week 4 or week 5 bye where they've gotten through the non-conference essentially, but then they can correct like some of the issues that have cropped up, and then they really hit their rhythm through October and into November. I think when you get that like that bye after like your 10th game or your 11th game. I just think that like that kind of screws you up a little bit.
Yeah.
Or in a school to be named later is bye after their 12th game, which is a nice little scheduling quirk from the Pac-12.
Yeah, we love it. So a couple of quick notes on this. You talked about Troy Williams. That was nice. It was senior night, so it was really cool to kind of see him go out like that. Utah was just crushing them. They had over 200 yards rushing in the first 30 minutes. Now, in the second half, Colorado had some life. Utah looked like they were sleepwalking a little bit. Their All-American punter had like a 22-yard punt. After Utah went 3-and-out for the first time in the game, it was like 31-13 at the time. Colorado was driving again, so they had got some momentum. I started to worry about the spread a little bit here. I don't know if you were kind of looking at that. They were in cover territory, but then Utah ended up getting a sack fumble. That kind of turned the tables. And if you watch Zach Moss, he was just trucking people the whole game. He finished with 196 yards and a couple of touchdowns. So Utah kind of fell asleep for a little while there, but they got that sack fumble. I thought it turned things around, and then it just wasn't going to be close.
Yeah, I want to say that if you're allowing well over 5 yards per carry throughout a game, it's pretty much impossible to come back from that sort of deficit. Like, if the team can run the ball on you and just grind clock and also convert first downs, like, you're gonna have a real tough time. So yeah, I mean, they got some benefit of some stuff in the second half that they weren't necessarily getting in the first half, but when Utah can run the ball like that, you're gonna have a tough time.
All right, so we're going to go to our next game. I get not really considered a rivalry game, but, two California schools. We had number 10.
California Golden Bears.
And number 9, they actually swapped places in the power rankings this week.
UCLA Bruins.
Yeah, and I guess this is technically, like, some sort of rivalry. I mean, I think it's, like, listed as such because these are two UC schools, but I don't know anybody who considers it like a super rivalry. UCLA won 30-27. And this was actually one of the more well-played games UCLA's played this year, maybe just being unencumbered by the speculation around Jim Mora and everything and just being able to play for their interim head coach and do the whole thing on senior night. But I thought they played really well. They played pretty inspired football. They won on a game-winning field goal with about eight seconds remaining from J.J. Molson from 37 yards. All that was pretty interesting and cool. Josh Rosen played the first half, looked really, really good. The biggest issue for UCLA in this game was that Pacal's pass rush was just able to get to him over and over and over again. Finally, he had one where he was just kind of thrown down on the ground. They're not saying whether it's a concussion or whether it's a shoulder injury or what it is. They just said they took him out for precautionary reasons, but he certainly didn't look right getting off the field. And then Devon Modster came in the second half, and he played pretty well. And both of those guys played pretty well, largely because Jordan Lasley, UCLA's star wide receiver, had his second straight just monster game after playing really well against USC. He put together 12 catches for 227 yards against Cal. So,
wow.
big couple of weeks for him. He's a redshirt junior. He actually walked for senior night, which is usually a pretty strong tell that a guy is thinking about jumping. And I think with his performances the last 2 weeks, he's suddenly propelled himself into a draftable. But all in all, it was a nice way for UCLA to end its season. For Cal, I thought they played hard and played well. They haven't been quite the same team away from Berkeley as they have been in Berkeley, but I thought this was one of their better road performances of the year. Ross Bowers played pretty well. Patrick Laird ran the ball really, really well.
He did, yeah.
And they did almost enough to win this, but just couldn't quite put enough together at the end.
Yeah, a couple of key – there was a – I think it was the first quarter. UCLA ended up fumbling, like, in their own red zone and then kind of held Cal to a field goal. I thought that was a big play. Like, a touchdown there could have changed things. UCLA couldn't run the ball early. They had, like, minus 31 rushing yards early in this game.
Yeah.
Patrick Laird, you mentioned, he actually went over the 1,000-yard rushing mark. Not in this game because that would be a record, but, like, for the season. So that's pretty cool. There was a point in the second quarter – where UCLA on their own side of the field, they got, I think it was like a running into the kicker. They were punting. It ends up making like a fourth and short. And Jed Fish decided to go for it. I saw you on Twitter like really loving that decision.
Yeah. And you know, there was a lot of talk before. So UCLA fans are a very beaten down group. We all know this. And as the Jim Mora firing was happening, everyone was already talking down UCLA's chances of landing a big-time head coach. And there were a lot of UCLA fans talking themselves into potentially a Jed Fish hiring at UCLA. And, I mean, first of all, that would be a very UCLA thing to do, or at least an old UCLA thing to do. But a lot of people were talking about, oh, the offense was so good. And, I mean, the offense is going to be good when you've got a guy like Josh Rosen. I don't think that's a real indicator of a guy potentially being head coach material. But some of the decisions he made in this game I thought were more indicative of a guy who's a good potential head coach. And he made a really good decision there. On fourth and it was a fourth and six, and they punted away from their own 30. Then they get a running into the kicker, and it's fourth and one. And Jim Mora would have 100% either taken the original punt or just punted again. But Fish not only went for it on the fourth down, but he was completely ready to go for it on the fourth down. He had the whole team ready to go for it. Like, they didn't need to call a timeout or anything, and then they just went for it. And first of all, going for fourth and one basically anywhere on the field is the right mathematical decision. Just let's just take that as a given. But the fact that he did it in that moment and did it and had it at basically no hesitation about it, I thought it was a really good sign for him, and hopefully speaks to some, you know, rudimentary math skills that are always good to have in a head coach.
Yeah, Cal ended up having like four field goal attempts in the first half, so I thought the UCLA defense kind of kept them, stopped them when they had to. There was one time when a kickoff returner for UCLA caught the ball out of bounds at like the four on a kickoff. I thought that was, those are always fun, you know, when the guy's going to kick it out of bounds, but you know, you catch it and you step out of bounds yourself. But that was really kind of scary in the second half when Josh Rosen didn't come out. You're like, uh-oh, this could be a problem. But, you know, it took Monster maybe a couple drives, but I thought he played well after that. They responded nicely. Cal tied the game, and they UCLA was able to come back. It just seemed to me there was a whole lot of bad special teams play, Dave. There was, like, bad kick punt returns all the time. And then some weird, like, time management at the end. Like, Justin Wilcox didn't use his timeouts at the end. There were, and, you know, he didn't kick a field goal where he could have kicked a field goal. There were some just weird spots there, I thought, that was, like, maybe not handled the best towards the end of the game.
Yeah, and I thought Fish is – I mean – so on the flip side of the Fish as a potential head coach, I thought his end-of-game stuff was a little weak. I mean, they won the game, and they kicked a game-winning field goal, so it's nitpicky, but clock management at the end was a little funky. UCLA had, I think, three timeouts at the Cal 25 with, like, 46 seconds to go, and they were moving the ball really well. Just from, like, you know, the whole game theory standpoint, you don't want to settle for a long field goal there, and for J.J. Molson, a 37-yarder is – you know, right at the edge of his automatic range. You'd ideally like to get at least 10 more yards or potentially even punch it into the end zone and take the whole kicking game out of the equation. I thought he played that pretty conservatively. I thought it was played pretty NFL-like, but the end result was fine. You know, they made the field goal, but, you know, that's the kind of thing I'd look for in a, you know, if you're trying to evaluate him as a potential head coach down the line, like, say, ASU is actually considering him. That's the kind of stuff I'd look at.
All right, let's move on. Our next game, we like to call this one the Territorial Cup, which is a cool name. We had
Arizona Wildcats.
And they were on the road taking on
Arizona State Sun Devils.
So UCLA had a quarterback injury at halftime. Arizona also had a quarterback injury at halftime of this one. ASU ended up winning 42-30. Arizona actually had a 24-14 lead at halftime, but Khalil Tate got dinged up. I want to say it was a shoulder injury right around halftime, and Brandon Dawkins came in then, and this offense just is not the same with Brandon Dawkins versus Khalil Tate. It just was not working the same. Dawkins isn't, and I know this is a funny thing to say when you're talking about Tate, but Dawkins isn't the thrower that Tate is, let alone the runner. Like, he can't make the same throws. He actually ran the ball pretty well in this one, 10 carries for 71 yards. Not as strong and physical a runner as Tate either, and so there were some first downs that he missed just because he didn't have the power to necessarily break through to the sticks, and throwing the ball just didn't generate much of anything in the pass attack. Game also kind of flipped when essentially coming out of halftime, I want to say Arizona State blocked a punt.
Yes.
Yeah, blocked a punt out of bounds at the Arizona 5. Yeah, on Arizona's first drive out of halftime, and that set Arizona State up for a touchdown from the 5 and then put it a three-point game almost immediately. And Arizona just wasn't doing anything offensively to make up for Tate's absence, and that was pretty much the story of the game. The second half was just all ASU. Just poured it in offensively and shut down the Tate-less Arizona attack.
For to give us a little bit of credit here, so we did not get the UCLA game right. I think the Bruins were favored by like 7. They didn't cover. We didn't get this one right. It was a pick'em. We both picked Arizona. We were covering both games when the starting quarterbacks went out.
We were covering both games at halftime.
Yeah,
covering both of these at halftime.
But at halftime the starting quarterbacks went out, and it was so this one started. Actually, the home team's now won the last 5 of these games. So just a little note there, Territorial Cup. It seems like that's good for the home teams. It was all Arizona to start. ASU went 3-and-out, Arizona touchdown. ASU 3-and-out, shanked a punt, Arizona touchdown. And then they bounced back, and then they scored it. But it was still, you know, it was all Tate in control, you know, in that first half. They get the ball, I think it was right before halftime, and they're driving, and they end up trying a, what's it called? They tried a Hail Mary, and that's where he got hit. And so he really got hurt on that last play of the second half, and then you get Brandon Dawkins starting. So it's, I think that fired up the Sun Devils a little bit in the second half. And that block punt you mentioned, I thought was huge. They had another, so it was a snap that was, it hit the punter in the hands, and he dropped it. And then they got it blocked. There was another punt where the punter dropped a snap, and he ended up trying to kick it left-footed. And Rich Rod ended up making a comment afterwards, like, we can't even catch a punt. But if you look at the, like, Arizona had 439 yards, 24 first downs. ASU had 390 yards and 18 first downs. But really, some of the mistakes in the second half, ASU just capitalized on them, and it was just, you know, they actually had more turnovers. ASU had 2 turnovers. Arizona only had 1. But ASU was able, when they got the ball, they were 11 of 13 on third down. So I thought they continued to move the sticks a lot better than Arizona. They were 7 of 16. It's not bad. But ASU just was really good on third downs and capitalized on some of those mistakes, like the screwed up punts. And just, you know, obviously with Tate being out, that was a big deal in this one. It was you know, you hate the tale of two halves, cliche or whatever, but that's really what it was.
Yeah, and so much of this was the fact that Arizona was consistently getting long fields to drive on in the second half, and Arizona State was consistently getting short fields. You know, the offense only had to go 2 plays 5 yards, 8 plays 30 yards, then there was an 8 play 75 yard, but then later on it was a 9 play 33 yard to score touchdowns. So, I mean, that's when you have 3 touchdown drives in the second half that only have to go a max of 33 yards. That's pretty good for your team.
Yeah.
Arizona's inability to punt the ball, consistent turning the ball over, that was the tale of the second half. And again, that's so much of it is they didn't have Tate out there who makes better decisions with the football, who can run a little bit better than Dawkins, who can throw a lot better than Dawkins. And when you don't have him out there, you're going to have to punt a lot more. And Arizona hasn't been a good punting team this year. And it's just not setting yourself up for success. I mean, this is a game where, again, you see how different this Arizona team is when they don't have Khalil Tate.
Yeah, it's night and day. And, you know, if you're Todd Graham and you're in the locker room, you're like, okay, guys, here we go. What do we got to do? Was it like 24 to 10 or whatever it was? He's like, all right, let's score a few touchdowns right out of halftime. So what do they do? Touchdown, touchdown. It's like,
right.
That's pretty good. Like, okay, that's what you want. All right, should we move on?
Let's do it.
So our number 7 team,
Utah Utes.
We already talked about them. Our number 6 team, like I said, this is a top half of the all powerful Pac-12 power rankings.
Arizona State Sun Devils.
And yet they still fire their coach. Our number 5 team, man, really impressive.
Oregon Ducks.
Yeah, we know it's the Beavers, but still. Second half of the season, you know, when Herbert came back, they looked really good. All right, the Apple Cup. So this was the premier game, Dave. This was the one. This was the one everyone wanted to watch. We had our number 4 team.
Washington State Cougars.
They weren't 4 at the time, though. And our number 3 team.
Washington Huskies.
Oh, man. So this was another one of the, like, really, really ugly games. Washington was up 34-0 after three quarters. They won 41-14. Gave Washington State the old palindrome. Luke Falk is a... is it fair to say he's a bad quarterback this year?
On the road, he is.
In an air raid offense, to throw for... So to only complete 66% of your passes in an air raid is actually pretty mediocre. To throw 13 picks in an air raid, I mean... Dude, that's not great. He threw three in this game. Washington State's offense in general was really mediocre in this one. I know Falk threw for 369 yards, but they ran for negative 24. Falk took some egregious sacks in this one, some that he had to take, some that he didn't have to take. He turned the ball over three times throwing it. He also had a bad fumble. He had a miserable game. The interesting part for me was that Washington State's defense, which had been so strong for most of this year, was able to do nothing against this Washington rushing attack. Washington was running the ball from the beginning of the game, and it just never let up. Jake Browning had to do very little in this game. Miles Gaskin handled the load. Savon Ahmed did a great, great job. It was a comprehensive beat down from Washington over Washington State. It's inexplicable how bad Washington State's defense was in this. And I think Washington had some stuff scouted out, because if you were watching the game, especially when they would show the like 22 film, every time Washington State would slant its defensive line or come in at an angle, Washington ran just in the opposite direction and would just get these huge chunk yardages. They must have had some sort of tell to know how the line was going to slant on certain plays in certain situations. But this was probably the worst game for Washington State's defense, the worst game for Alex Grinch and his defense.
The second best, run defense in the conference just got gashed. And it was sort of like, big brother, little brother grows up with big brother, gets the crap beat out of him all the time. Little brother goes to like martial arts camp and like working out and like comes back and you're like, oh yeah, it's on, and Big Brother just smashes him. It doesn't matter. It was so bad. Like even pregame, Dave. I don't know if you saw this. Like Mike Leach and Chris Peterson are hanging out. Mike Leach, trying to eat a banana. He can't even get the damn banana in his mouth. Did you see that? That was ridiculous.
I did not see that.
They were showing them like just kind of chatting out. It was like I think someone made a meme out of it or something too. Like him trying to eat a banana. Jake Browning, so this is why we criticize Jake Browning. Like, obviously, Washington dominated. Browning was 11 of 17 for 93 yards. He didn't need to do anything in this game. And there's so many of Washington's wins or kind of times where you don't need Jake Browning to do all that much. He doesn't make any mistakes. He's fine. Until we saw that, the comeback game, we didn't really see, what was that? The Utah game where I thought he played well. These are the kind of games where you're just like, yeah, it's like Jake Browning was there, but he wasn't like an integral part of this. Obviously Miles Gaskin, four touchdowns, 192 yards. The weird thing, you mentioned, so 14 rushes for Washington State. Most of those were Falk, like getting sacked and stuff. That's the fewest rushing yards by either an Apple Cup team ever. Jamal Murrow only got five carries. I think they had six attempted rushes. Like, how do you do that? Like, He had 10 catches for 76 yards, so he was involved in the offense. But it's like Mike Leach decided we are not going to run the ball, and they didn't.
Yeah, I think there was a weird dynamic between Leach and Falk all year. Because Falk, so I think a lot of their running game is calls at the line whether or not Falk wants to run it or not. And I think at the beginning of the year, they might have been running the ball a little bit more than Leach would like. Morrow himself had double-digit carries in four games this year, which is kind of a lot for an air raid scheme. And they seem to really shut that off in the last couple of games, not running the ball more. And I don't know if that played into the dynamic that was kind of weird between Falk and Leach. Leach pulled them in two games this year. And Falk just never looked quite right this season. He kept... you know, checking down to underneath receivers, even when there'd be something open downfield. He just looked kind of tentative. I mean, it's just, it's weird the way his career went. And I wonder how much that affected the rush game and whether or not they even ran the ball in certain games. Cause I think a lot of it is on him to make that decision. You know, based off of whether they want to, you know, take advantage of a certain matchup, but it was, I don't know why they would only run the ball. I mean, they only had 6 true rushes in this game.
Yeah.
That's insane.
That's nuts. And it's not, you know, Washington was 2 of 9 on third down. And actually, Chris Peterson after the game was mentioned in, like, doing well against the defense, and they did pretty good on third down. Like, not really. But there wasn't a lot of negative plays. Washington State ended up forcing 4. They usually force a lot more than that. Washington ended up getting 7. Washington did a lot of those negative plays with just a 3-man rush, too. Like, they just dropped dudes into coverage, and that's how they got, you know, like a bunch of tip balls. You got the 3 forced interceptions, and that strategy worked. If you look at Washington State's first 10 drives, I'm going to read these to you, okay? Punt, punt, interception, fumble, punt, punt, interception, punt, interception, punt. So,
damn.
You know, by then, it's game over.
Yeah, and they only scored once, I mean, Washington was done with the game. I mean, it was the fourth quarter, and they were up by 34. I mean, it was like it was a laugher at that point. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see what this Washington State offense looks like next year. If Leach is still there, we'll see about that. He's certainly getting named as a candidate for a couple different positions. I don't know how likely any of that is, but assuming he's still there, have defenses caught up to this offensive scheme, or was this a Luke Falk issue? I think that's going to be maybe a storyline this offseason.
No, I think you're right there. I mean, it was much more inconsistent play from him all year. Leach was asked about if they wanted to bench him, but I think he felt it was just the team was playing poorly more than just him. You know, losing Hercules Mata'afa too, he got ejected for targeting, which I didn't get to see the play. Did you see that one? Was it like a real targeting?
Yeah, no. I mean, they thought it was on the. It wasn't a dirty play. Like he was actually tackling heads up. And he hit, I think it was Browning, on basically the chin guard. And so, by the letter of the law, it was targeting. It was another one of those that, you know, we've talked about this on the pod. It would have been that flagrant 1, not the flagrant 2.
Gotcha.
Like a 15-yarder for sure. The kind of thing that knocks a guy out of the game. I didn't think so.
Yeah. Dante Pettis ended up getting hurt in this one, but didn't really matter. This is 5 straight Apple Cups for Washington, so they've dominated the series. And Adam Jude, who does a great job covering it for I believe he's with the Seattle Times. So the 4 Apple Cup showdowns for Chris Peterson, they've outscored Mike Leach's Cougars 162-54 overall and 90-13 in the first half. So this was right along those same lines where it's just a blowout in the first half. Little bit ugly. Okay, so now we're going to go to our number 2 team.
Stanford Cardinal.
It's been a while since Stanford's been up this high, and they were a non-conference this week. They took hosted Notre Dame.
Notre Dame. Stanford won 38-20. A little bit of a deceptive final score. This was a much closer game for most of it than you would think from that score. Stanford actually was down 17-20 with a minute 23 to go in the third quarter. And then they poured on 21 points really quickly. It was actually really interesting to see the way it happened. First, Stanford led KJ Costello, his stats aren't going to look spectacular in this one, but he played a great game. I mean, he threw 4 touchdowns, so I guess that does look spectacular, but only 176 yards. But he was just kind of flawless in his decision-making. Justified everything we've said about him on this podcast for the last however many weeks. He should have been starting all year. But he was finally starting here at the end, and he played a great game. He led a nice drive to put Stanford ahead 24-20. And then on the subsequent drive, just the wheels kind of started to fall off for Notre Dame. Brandon Wimbush on the first play from scrimmage throws a pick where he just does not see Curtis Robinson dropping into coverage. So that's, you know, Stanford took over at the 29-yard line. They punch it in really quickly. Again, KJ Costello just playing really, really well. Throws a nice little dump off to Dalton Schultz. And, you know, all those big Stanford tight ends that they've essentially had for the last 12 years. They were all, you know, in playing in force in this one. So they score a touchdown, go up 31-20. Then on the ensuing kickoff, the Notre Dame return guy fumbles the ball at, I think it was like the 18-yard line, 20-yard line, something like that. Stanford again just goes back and punches it in. And at that point, it was 38-20. And this wasn't the kind of game where, except for absurd circumstances like that, no team is going to score 21 points in quick fashion. This was a real ball control game until those mistakes for Notre Dame. And Stanford's just too good of a team. They're going to capitalize on that stuff. And with KJ Costello playing the way he is, Bryce Love apparently able to play on that torn up ankle. He averaged 6 yards per carry in this one. So he's, you know, even having to come out every other play because his ankle was bothering him, he was still phenomenal. This is a different Stanford team playing pretty well here at the end of the year.
They are. And if you look the first half of the game, I thought it was back and forth, but there was no turnovers. And I think that was kind of the key. Stanford was, you know, they were 0-7 on third down, I think through three quarters. So it was, they were not converting. And, you know, that was sort of a problem. That's why the game was kind of close, I thought. But, you know, great throw from Costello, I think, to start the fourth quarter. They put him up 24-20. And then it was really about the Stanford defense to me. So they intercepted Winbush. They, you know, Stanford quickly turned that into another touchdown to go up a couple scores. Then they forced a fumble. So there was no turnovers until that point. And then Stanford really piled it on with the three fourth quarter touchdowns for the Cardinals. So I thought it was – I don't think there's a great Stanford defense. And I don't know. You know, they played pretty well for parts of this game. I just didn't think Notre Dame played all that well. They kind of peaked at the USC game. And then since then, they've just been kind of, it's more of a one-dimensional sort of squad. Love didn't really have any huge runs. I think he had like a 31-yard run, but he had, you know, 20 carries for 125, even though he was injured. Notre Dame had some nice, you know, there was a nice drive, I think, where Notre Dame was kind of driving towards the end, but then Winbush ended up throwing a pick in the end zone. So this is actually 6 straight home games against top 10 teams for Stanford that they have won. So that's pretty cool. They're 12-0 in non-conference home games, and they're 3-0 versus Notre Dame. So pretty cool. And then, you know, the win didn't matter. Obviously, Washington State losing, but this will be the fourth time in 6 years that the Stanford's going to make the Pac-12 championship game. So pretty big deal for David Shaw. And, you know, after, you know, being 1-2 at one point in this season, nice comeback to be able to make the Pac-12 title game. Which we predicted, right? Didn't we pick Stanford to
I want to say we did.
We did.
I want to say we did. And I mean, to end up 9-3 with this team, especially after the way they started the year, looking really shaky, the fact that they've had no real stability at quarterback, mostly through their own doing, but the fact that they haven't had that, and they've still, I mean, they were 3 points against San Diego State and 3 points against Washington State from being 11-1. I mean, that's a real thing. That's true.
Yeah.
And that's crazy. I think once David Shaw realizes what he has in KJ Costello, even beyond like starting him at quarterback, but I think he could be doing more in this pass game. I thought, you know, one of the things that was clamping down on the Stanford offense early was the Stanford offense. They tried to do a lot of that power stuff that they're just not quite equipped for. And so a lot of their third down issues were just trying to do that, you know, kind of ogre package stuff that teams first have really scouted out. And they didn't seem to be willing to play action out of it or do anything besides just kind of pound it up the middle. And I think once David Shaw starts to really trust Costello, and maybe that doesn't happen this year, maybe it's a next year thing, but once he starts to really trust him, I think the offense is going to get the, you know, the child wheels. What am I saying? The training wheels. There we go. Training wheels taken off of it, and then potentially get back to being a pretty elite unit next year.
Yeah, it's, I mean, you want to say, like, Pac-12 schedule, like we talked about teams getting screwed. They did lose their 2 games after they came back from Australia, you know? So
it's
after that, they were pretty good. Now, and, you know, I did a USC podcast today where we'll talk about the championship game in a little bit. And was like, oh, Stanford's been playing well, like, the, you know, second half of the season. Not the entire, I mean, they got really lucky to beat Oregon State, you know, by a point. There's been some, you know, kind of moments where they just weren't even looking all that good. But, I, you know, you look at, it wasn't a dominating win against Cal, but they got the win. You know, it was a really good win against Notre Dame. You know, being able to beat Washington on that Friday night game, it's, you know, they're going to have some momentum going into this Pac-12 championship game. And even though if you listen to David Shaw on the conference today, you know, ideally you don't want to be coming off a tough game like that and then turning around in 6 days and playing the Pac-12 championship game against a team that's coming off a bye. He said that no one deserved the bye more than USC, though, because they got, you know, they have 12 weeks in a row. But the nice part is, Dave, at least they only have to drive. They're not like, if it was Washington State and they were going to go to Seattle, come back, and then 6 days later try to fly to Santa Clara to play a rested USC, that would be a lot more unfair. At least Stanford can drive.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think it's going to be a fun game. And we'll, you know, we'll get into our real preview in just a second. We still got to name who our top team is.
Oh,
The power rankings. Come on, Ryan. We have an order of things here.
The Podcast of Champions power rankings. The end of the regular season. The number one team is
USC Trojans.
Honestly.
And I just picked that myself. I'm a homer. I just did that myself. Dave had no say in the rankings.
Yeah, no, I had no say. But it's, I mean, come on, it's valid. So USC taking on Stanford. Are we ready to jump right into this?
I think we should. We don't have a whole bunch of games to preview this week because there's only one game left. Yep. We'll do bowl previews and all that kind of stuff. But, yeah, it's USC versus Stanford.
All right. So this game is going to be on Friday at 5 p.m. on ESPN. Stanford playing USC at, what is it, Levi Stadium? Is that what we're calling it these days?
Levi Stadium.
Whatever placeholder it is before the Vegas Stadium gets built. USC is favored by 3 points. This opened at 2.5, moved to USC by 3. Really interesting game because there's a lot at play here. First, these two teams have already played this year. USC beat them 42-24, and the game was pretty ugly, actually. USC played really, really well in that game. Stanford did not play pretty well. And they were still starting Keller Christ at that time,
yes.
Which was a different animal. I think.
I don't think Costello even played in that game. I don't think they brought him in at all.
I don't think he did either. And so this is a different animal of a Stanford team since then. KJ Costello is obviously much more of a gamer, much more of a guy who can make things happen, can do a little bit more outside of the pocket, and just kind of freelance a little bit more than Keller Christ, and has also just been a more accurate, better thrower. So from that perspective, Stanford's offense is a little bit better. But Stanford did have a healthy Bryce Love at that point, and Bryce Love, for all that he's doing right now, is not healthy, and this game is coming after just 6 days off, or 5 days off. You know, only 6 days between Stanford's last game and this one. So there's all that playing into this. And then, but USC is actually sort of going on the road for this one, whereas Stanford is playing a pseudo home game, and road teams have generally not been faring too well in the Pac-12 this year. I don't know. How are you breaking this down right now?
Well, the bye week is interesting because, like I talked to before, you know, there's 5 November bye weeks. 3 of the 4 teams have lost and looked bad doing it. Now USC really just kind of took the week off for their bye week. Like, they didn't do anything last week that we've seen. They're going to start. I'm going to go to their first practice today right after this podcast. And I'm curious to see kind of how they use it to prepare. But I think this was a team that just needed a week off after the 12 straight weeks. You talk to the guys, they're like, they've never done that in their lives before, which I guess makes sense. Like, you're never going to expect to do that. USC's offensive line played their best game against Stanford earlier in the year. And I think people looked at that USC game against Stanford. They're like, that's the way they should play. Well, they never really got back to that point. Like, they played pretty well against Arizona State, but the best they played all year was against Stanford. So basically 11 other times they played, they didn't look this good. I'm not expecting them to look as good as they did. And I think Stanford's going to play better. I think Costello's going to be a little bit better at taking advantage of some of the mismatches on the outside with the tight ends and stuff. And USC's secondary has given up a lot of big plays this year. Now, they force a lot of negative plays. And, you know, I think you can kind of get teams off, you know, behind the chains a little bit. So maybe you give up one big play, but you get a sack or something, and USC, you know, gets a lot of sacks, and maybe you force a team to punt. To me, it's going to really come down to, it's not been a great Stanford defense all year. USC's run offense, it should be good, but they didn't really take advantage of UCLA, which was like the worst run defense in the world. you know, how well does Sam Darnold play? If they, if it's similar, like the, I think it would be similar to Notre Dame game, but if USC starts turning the ball over, Stanford will win. If USC doesn't turn the ball over, I think they can win. But to me, it's kind of a pick 'em, Dave. I'm not really sure. It's just hard to tell which USC team, which Stanford team are going to come out. But I kind of have a feeling the first half of the Notre Dame game will kind of give a feel like this game might look a lot like that.
Yeah, what I would say is, so Stanford's rush defense hasn't been great this year, but it has been better of late. They've given up 4.6 yards per rush attempt this year, but 4.2 over the last three games, which is, you know, getting into the top 40 range.
Yeah, especially against Notre Dame is one of those teams, you know.
And Notre Dame is a good rushing attack.
Yeah.
So being able to do that, I think, was impressive. That's the kind of thing that might, you know, potentially get them in a more competitive situation against this USC rushing attack. The interesting, I think there are some matchups in that USC secondary that maybe favor them against a team like Stanford more than against a team with really athletic receivers. Like, this is a game where I think Biggie Marshall can actually play pretty well at corner because he's going to be matched up against bigger, a little bit slower receivers.
Yeah.
And he's had a bit of a rough year. And so I think he might be able to, you know, have a better game in this one. He's kind of designed for that. He's got more of a safety build, more of a physical build. And if you put him in press coverage against some of these bigger guys, he might be able to show up pretty well. On the other hand, I think Jack Jones, this is not a matchup designed for Jack Jones. A lot of big, tall guys who might be able to body him up pretty well. So, yeah, I'm with you. I think it's a pick 'em. I think for me, I'm going to take just based off the home road splits for everybody in the Pac-12 this year, basically. I think I'm going to take Stanford to win. I think, you know, they've been there before. There's a lot of factors in this for Stanford. I think KJ Costello is playing well. He's playing like Kevin Hogan reincarnate in big games. And I think they're just playing well at this point in the year. They've, you know, they just knocked off a top 10 team. I think they'll be in a rhythm, and I think USC might have a little bit of rust coming off that bye week, especially coming after, you know, a big rivalry win the previous week. I think they might just have a little bit of rust on them now, and I think that'll be enough for Stanford.
Yeah, I'm going to keep with my not picking USC to cover spreads and take Stanford. It's worked pretty well for me most of the year. I think they're like 3-8 against the spread, or what would they be? No, it's like, they might be 4-8 or 3-9 or something like that against the spread. So I'm gonna stick with a 2, getting 3 points. Like I think it's a pick 'em. So any side, if USC was getting 3 points, I'd probably pick them. Like just betting wise, but yeah, I think I'll take Stanford in this one. I think it's a really important game for USC. It's a really important game for you know, Stanford's been there before. You know, the South hasn't won this game before. There's, I think Clay Helton, especially with like Chip Kelly getting hired, and who knows who comes in Arizona State. A lot of USC fans aren't happy with the way USC's been playing, and they had the best record in the Pac-12 because they just haven't looked really good in all those games. That's why they haven't been covering those spreads. So this is really important for Clay Helton. And you're talking about going to the Fiesta Bowl versus the Alamo Bowl. I think it's a really big deal. So do they, you know, tense up a little bit? Or are they going to play loose and free? I'm just not sure at this point, but with the 3 points there, I think it could be really close. So I'll take the points in Stanford.
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting point about, and this is something maybe I want to ask about with Chip Kelly being hired at UCLA. Obviously, that has reverberations everywhere, but certainly at USC. I made a joke on Twitter, but I was kind of surprised by the number of USC fans who were like, "Yep." Because I said, you know, Chip Kelly being hired at UCLA immediately puts a guy who's potentially going to go 10-2 and win the conference on the extremely hot seat entering next year. And the number of USC fans who were willing to say, oh, yes, 100%, and that's completely justified, was stunning to me. Like, stunning.
Well, I think a
and
lot of them.
I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think a lot of them wanted him on the hot seat anyway. Like, I had people tweeting me, like, well, Chip Kelly's hired. Should they fire Helton now? And it's like, he's 10-2 and 8-1 in the conference. And like, he was sitting home, like waiting for who they were going to play in the championship game. So there's, okay, it's really split up. It's, you know, kind of like our country, just really divided with this stuff. There's people that get mad at me if I say like, yeah, I think Chip Kelly's going to be good. He's like, what are you talking about? Like, Clay Helton's the greatest ever, blah, 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 blah. And then there's other people who are like, why don't they want to fire Helton every day. It doesn't matter. And he could win by 100. They just think he was a bad hire, and they shouldn't be the coach. It's like this just crazy extreme on both sides. And that's why I think it's really important where if you're not a Clay Helton fan, you're a USC fan, you don't really like Clay Helton, and, you know, he shouldn't have been hired and all that kind of stuff. To see UCLA go out and get this home run, it makes them even more upset. But I think if you're a USC fan and you don't like Clay Helton, if he wins the conference, like, then you should just be like, all right, that's fine. You know, he won the conference. That's a good thing. That's not easy to do. They hadn't done it since 2008. So I think you have to just kind of put your differences aside at that point. But there are plenty of USC fans out there, Dave, that would love to see the snark that you have on Twitter. And there's so many that are going to be mad. Like, if Chip Kelly does well, they're not going to want to talk to me because I thought he'd be well. If Chip Kelly bombs, I'm going to get a lot of emails that, see, I told you he was going to be terrible and blah, 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 blah. Like, it's crazy, like, the kind of divide this has created.
Yeah, it's nuts. And, like, I think the USC job is a good enough job that it's never going to get – it's never going to have that toxic feel that Tennessee's currently has. But when you start – like, really seriously considering firing a guy who might very well win the conference this year, and, like, not illegitimately, like, it's not like he's winning the South with, like, a 7-5 record and, you know, lucking into a conference championship. If he wins it this year, it's going to be because USC went 11-2. When you start, like, semi-seriously considering firing that guy, it starts to make the job look a little bit high pressure. Like, a little bit maybe and so it would be interesting to see what I like from a curiosity standpoint, from like watching a car wreck kind of way, I'd be interested to see what would happen if they ended up firing Clay Helton. But obviously that's not going to happen in a real world.
And, you know, I think Lynn Swann, they won the Rose Bowl last year, and Lynn Swann, the new athletic director, was like, that's not good enough. Like, you got to win the conference. So he kind of put him on notice anyway. So if he doesn't win the conference, there's going to be a lot of chirping. It's going to make my life a lot harder, I think, if they lose this game, because I'm going to be, like, hearing about it and, like, fielding questions. You know, I'm still, like, fielding questions all the time about replacing him and, you know, replacing all the assistants and all this kind of stuff. But if they lose the title game, I'm really going to hear about it.
Yep. All right, should we get to questions?
We should. Do you want to do a random voicemail first? Do you want to start emails? What would you like to do?
Can you tell how long the voicemails are?
They're all, like, a little over a minute. I don't think there's anything like too long.
Okay, let's listen to a random voicemail.
All right, here's the first one. No idea what's on it. Here we go.
Yeah, hey, this is Bruin Bruiser. Just wanted to call again. Love the show. Had a couple of quick comments. One, I'm very excited as a UCLA fan about the Chip Kelly hiring. So I think today was kind of a bad day for USC Trojans. I saw some of the comments on Ryan's Twitter feed. But not only did UCLA get Chip Kelly, but with Michigan losing, so Ohio State winning, and also Alabama losing, I think that should probably do it for any hopes of SC sneaking into the playoffs. But I'd love to hear your opinion on that. But I don't think the committee's going to take SC over Alabama. So that's kind of a firewall. At least that's what I hope. And then the other thing I wanted to say is, living on the East Coast now, as much as we have a rivalry with our friends from USC, the Gator fans are much, much, much worse. I'm sure Wood, living in Georgia, sees a lot of them. I'm a little bit further north up the eastern seaboard, but I see plenty of them too. And the Gator fans are far more entitled, far more nasty, and far more delusional than even our coaching friends. So that's what I wanted to say. Thanks a lot. Keep up the good work. Bye.
You know, that was actually a pretty common sentiment among some UCLA people I talked to, which was like, oh, wow, listening to all these SEC people, it really makes you develop some fondness for the USC fans across town, because at least they can form sentences and, you know, have reason and logic to back them up. But, yeah, no, I mean, SEC fans, they're a whole – I mean, you're married to one, but they're a whole – they're a whole brand of crazy, like a whole new brand, and it's great, and we love them for it, but, man – but yeah, I mean, I think USC is probably out of the playoff conversation.
Yes.
I think not enough dominoes fell, this past weekend, but that's fine. I mean, this wasn't a Pac-12 league that was gonna, I don't think anybody is eager to see one of these Pac-12 teams play against anybody included in that playoff conversation right now. I think Auburn would just crush the life out of anybody in the Pac-12. I think Bama still would. So I think any Pac-12 team should be completely fine going to the Fiesta Bowl and just having a nice season.
Yeah. Do you want to jump? I don't know. Where did our questions start on the emails?
We're starting with Eric. You want me to start off there?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right, comments for the podcast of champions.
Man, long. Holy crap.
Yeah, this is from Eric. Hi, first off, let me say I enjoy the show. The Washington Huskies are my second favorite team behind my alma mater, the Oklahoma Sooners, and I rely on your show to give me some insight into the rest of the Pac-12. I am emailing because I have a few thoughts on the UW versus Utah game. In your last show, you talked about the head-scratching decisions Kyle Whittingham made at the end of the fourth quarter that helped UW get the win. These include trying to win the game in regulation by passing after the game was tied and calling timeout when UW had the ball, hoping for a win by screw-up. Think UW versus Arizona in 2014. Actually, Whittingham was rolling the dice all throughout the game. He also went for it on 4th-and-1 at the 47 early in the first quarter. That's not rolling the dice. That's the right move. Went for an onside kick in the first quarter and went for it on 4th-and-17 deep in their own territory early in the fourth quarter with the game tied. Without these plays, Utah could have had 17 points and 150-plus yards less than their final total, resulting in a comfortable Washington win. So it's no surprise they kept rolling the dice late in the game since it had been going so well up to that point. What would you have said if they had failed on that fake punt and UW had the ball in Utah's red zone? Eventually, Utah's high-risk gambling caught up to them. I think that's a fair point.
Yeah, I like that.
In addition, I noticed the announcers constantly talking about Utah's injuries throughout the game while neglecting to mention that UW was banged up as well. What about UW's best O-lineman or the heir apparent to John Ross, Chico McClatchy, or the freshman tight end who was emerging as a favorite target of Browning, Hunter Bryant? I imagine Jordan Miller would have been helpful against Utah's taller wide receivers. For some reason, we heard a single mention of Adams and that's it, while seemingly hearing endless mentions of how banged up Utah's defense was. It was weird. The narrative of this game should be a banged up while Utah faced a banged up Washington. Utah threw the kitchen sink at them, but fell short when their luck ran out. I'm going to make a very nice compliment to Washington right now. The reason you heard less about Washington's injuries is because Chris Peterson is not whining about those injuries to the television crew before the game. When you hear a bunch about the injuries to a particular team, it's because the coach or the staff or whatever is whining to the announcers before games. That's why UCLA, the narrative in every single one of their games after about the third game of the year was how many injuries they had, because that's what the memo was from UCLA to the TV crew before the game. Chris Peterson's not whining about injuries, which I think is a good and healthy thing for the head coach of a winning program to be doing.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. We had one from Richard in East LA, but this was before Chip Kelly was hired. Should we just skip this one, or I can do it real quick if you want? Or he said, "I'm sending this."
No, you can skip this one. It's, okay. So Richard makes a funny joke, and I'm going to say it. He's joking that Bobby Petrino should have been on the candidate list, which would have been really funny. Not necessarily a fit at UCLA, at least in olden times, but here in our brand new era where UCLA is out here hiring Chip Kelly, maybe.
Yeah.
I think Bobby Petrino is a great offensive coach. Like lowest character guy out there, but great, great offensive coach.
Yeah. This one's Colorado Utah rivalry, a suggestion. He said apparently this was a rivalry until around 1962, and he gives us a Wikipedia page, Rumble in the Rockies. If they want to build that up, they should do two things. Revive the name Rumble in the Rockies. It's a great name. I kind of like
it
that.
It sure is. Yeah, 100%.
Create a trophy. Every dumb game in the Big Ten has one, and players get really excited and parade around the field with it after a win. How about the horn of a mountain goat? Michael,
I love it.
Maybe Michael should be like the commissioner of the Pac-12. Like, Michael, we're going to...
Michael has shown more qualifications in this email to be Pac-12 commissioner than Larry Scott has ever shown. So, Michael for Pac-12 commissioner.
We love it. Let's do it.
All right. Next one. This is from John from San Jose. Ryan and David, thank you for a great year with your honesty in covering the Pac-12. This morning I saw the news about UCLA hiring Chip Kelly. It is a big boost for UCLA and the Pac-12, but makes Trojan fans nervous. My questions for both of you are... David, how quickly would Chip Kelly turn UCLA into a legitimate threat for the Pac-12 title and a playoff contender? So here's that's the big question, right? Now, I think if he's a truly elite coach, and I think he is, but we should see, I mean, everyone out there should see results immediately. And I don't know if result is a playoff contender in year one, but I think there's enough talent in that program. With all the way they played this year, there's still a ton of talent in this program. Development got very bad this year. Scheme was very bad this year, but there's a lot of talented bodies. I think going 9-3 next year is completely doable. The schedule's a little bit tough. They get Oklahoma in the non-conference. That'll be a tough game. But I think it's there to do 9-3, and whether, you know, going 6-3 or so, or 5-4 or whatever, or no, 5-4, but 7-2 or 6-3 in the conference will be good enough to win the South. That'll depend on, you know, whether Sam Darnold comes back or what happens with ASU, or, you know, if Utah can put it together again. But I think they should be in competition for the South next year. And then I think within 2 years, if Chip Kelly is what we all think he is, I think they should be competing in a real way for the Pac-12 conference in 2 years, and potentially a playoff berth at that point.
Agree there. And he wants to know, how worried should USC be about Chip Kelly at UCLA on and off the field? No, I mean, I think it's something that, like, it's a rising tide lifts all boats, that sort of thing. I think it makes USC have to get their house in order. I think they kind of, you could almost argue they kind of sleptwalk to a 10-2 season this year. The big, you know, the Pac-12 South wasn't all that great. They didn't lose a game in the Pac-12 South, but I they didn't look really good, like, the whole way. And I don't think you could do that if Chip Kelly does what I think he's going to do at UCLA. You're not going to be able to do that every week, you know, every year. So I think it's going to make, you know, USC is going to have to kind of, you know, internalize and look at themselves and say, hey, we need to do this better, we need to do that better. So if anything, I don't think you're, like, it's something to be worried about, but it's something that you're like, hey, maybe it's a wake up call. You make yourselves do some things better than you were doing, I guess, at this point.
Yep.
Okay, let's see. Next one we got. This is Dave. Hey, Ryan and Dave. What a week. Ryan, it's really crazy. I keep reading on the P that UCLA would never be the destination for an elite football coach, and then I learned that Chip Kelly is, in fact, not an elite football coach from the same people. It really is interesting. That's not everybody. Like, there's a bunch of people that didn't think that. And to be fair, Dave, they didn't want USC to hire him back then either. It's not like just because UCLA hired him. There's some people that just didn't want him. It really is interesting learning from the quote-unquote blue bloods across town. As impressed as I am, we can steal a coach from under the nose of a traditional SEC power. It's not nearly as impossible. I'm sorry. As impressive as hiring and firing Sarkisian or Sarkiffin and promoting Clay Helton internally. Oh, no. 100% right, Dave. Dave, I think that's when we know we've truly arrived, when we promote a non-play-calling offensive coordinator that literally no other no other Power 5 team wants. Very cool, very elite. Anyway, it seems like and they spelled USC wrong with the dollar sign, UC.
Yeah, it's a common misspelling. I wonder if it's a keyboard issue.
I think it is. Fan base is taking this well and not posting end-of-the-world proclamations or trying to convince themselves that Chip is not actually a good coach. On to my question. Has there ever been a crosstown rivalry game where, in hindsight, the winners may have really lost and the losers are probably glad they didn't win? If UCLA wins that game, Moore is most likely still the coach at SUC and still going to the Pac-12 title game. Funny how things work out. Dave's Sophie's Choice, Ben Albright or Clay Travis?
And, so Sophie's
sorry,
Choice
okay,
is...
Shit. Okay, sorry.
So Sophie's Choice is obviously which one will I save. I think I'd save Clay Travis here, but only because you're friends with him.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks,
Ben
Dave.
Ben Albright, for those of you who don't know, he's just one of those NFL draft nonsense people on Twitter who had some really stupid takes on UCLA stuff, so I got into it with him a little bit. But
nice.
Clay Travis, as everyone knows, is a paid troll for vaguely associated with Fox Sports.
And this is from Zach. I read Dave at the end, but that was a question for you, Dave. So, and the title of his email was Chip FU%KING Kelly.
FU percentage king.
Yeah, FU percentage king Kelly. Nice.
Yeah.
I never heard that one there. So, okay, so as far as the rivalry game, if you can argue that Clay Helton was smart, he kept UCLA in that game. He didn't make made it close. He did all he could.
He was trying.
So I think, you know, they tried to make it so if they blew him out, then you're like going to run him out of town. But I think this was a case where they thought they could get Chip Kelly, so they were kind of do this. But to be fair to the guys on the P, there's guys when I would suggest, like, 2 years ago, hey, USC should go get Chip Kelly. That's home run. And I agree with you. Like, USC's administration was not thinking home run. They were thinking, you know, bunt or whatever. And I, you know, Clayton's one of the nicest guys. I know. He's like great guy. He's always been nice to us and stuff. But that's not for USC. You don't hire a guy that's never been, you know, a head coach before. In my opinion, now we'll see. You know, he's won 10 games 2 years in a row. Maybe he develops into a really good coach. But it wasn't a home run kind of hire like Chip Kelly. I wanted to see USC do something that UCLA did. Now, not all USC fans agree because a lot of them, you know, they have whatever they want to say about Chip Kelly. But to be fair, they were saying that when I was telling them that USC should hire him. So it's not just because UCLA got him.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
And then whose business has the Chip hiring been better for, Bro or the P?
Oh, I mean, anytime a coach gets hired, it's better for the site of the school that hired him.
It would have been better to have a longer coaching search because the longer the search is better.
Yeah, So, in terms of, like, interest, the most interest is during a coaching search.
Yes.
That's when everything is just – because everyone's so intrigued by the whole thing. So,
yeah.
But, I think there's a lot of excitement in UCLA circles now. All right, from Anthony. Hi, Ryan and Dave. What are your three favorite Pac-12 games this year? Oh, my gosh. He's asking us to remember. Washington State USC was fun.
That was fun, yeah. Some of the Arizona ones with Khalil Tate were just fun. Like, I don't like which one would
Arizona go. Yeah, it was like Arizona, Colorado, his real coming out party where he had like 300 plus yards filling in for Brandon Dawkins. That was a lot of fun. I'll throw that one in there.
Like Washington at Stanford, like the Stanford win there.
That wasn't a fun game to watch, though. Like, it was not
fun.
Like, honestly, one of my favorite Pac-12 games was Stanford-Notre Dame, and that only involved one Pac-12 team. And UCLA-Texas A&M was a ton of fun.
That
to
was
watch,
fun.
Too.
That was a fun one. USC-Texas was overtime. Like, that was pretty exciting. But I don't know about, like, as far as fun goes. Like,
there weren't a lot of great Pac-12 games this year.
What are some of the Oregon ones? Like Oregon with the Herbert. They beat the crap out of Arizona. That wasn't...
They lost to Arizona State. I mean, that was an interesting game. But it wasn't... Like, there weren't a lot of, like, close, really competitive games this year.
Yeah, that was 37-35, so that was pretty good.
That was pretty good. Okay. Yeah, let's say that. One of the two Khalil Tate explosions, I'd say the Colorado one was fun. Or UCLA. What he did to UCLA was also fun. And USC, Washington State. Let's go with those. Sound good?
Sure. I like that.
And then he said, can you pick the AAC and other Power 5 conference championship games? Are we going to add this to the list?
No, we're not adding this to the list. I don't even watch these teams.
I know. I watch so many Pac-12 games. Like, this is what we do for you people. I watch so many garbage Pac-12 games when there were other things on this year. Like, Saturday, there were, like, epic games going on. Like, Auburn-Alabama was going on, and I think I turned on Arizona-Arizona State. Like, I think I was sitting there watching Arizona-Arizona State instead of watching Auburn-Alabama.
Yeah.
That's what I do for you.
But we can go through these lists and just pick them, you know, and just see. But
let's just pick the winners. All right, okay. Memphis, UCF. I go UCF.
Yeah, UCF.
Oklahoma, TCU. I'm going to go TCU in the upset.
Okay, I'll take Oklahoma.
Auburn wins the rematch over Georgia for me.
Yeah, I think Auburn there. I'll take Clemson over Miami.
I'm going to say Miami here.
Okay.
I'm going to say they bounce back from that Pitt loss.
And I kind of think Wisconsin's going to run the table here and beat Ohio State. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree.
Really? Okay, I think Ohio State's probably favored in that game, but I don't know.
They are by, like, five, but I think Wisconsin, once you're, like, undefeated like that, it's kind of, like, a different thing to lose. Like, it's just, I think they're going to be able to do it. And then based upon your conference championship picks, who are your four playoff teams? Oh, man.
So I'd say Wisconsin, because they won the Big Ten. Auburn.
Miami.
I'm picking Clemson, so I'd say Clemson, but you pick Miami.
All right, so whichever winner of the ACC.
Yeah, and then Oklahoma.
All right, so Auburn, Oklahoma, Wisconsin, and then Clemson, Miami.
Yeah.
That's fun. That involves at least three new teams in the playoff this year.
Now, what would be more fun for the playoff committee would be, like, Ohio State winning, and then do you put Ohio State in over Alabama, stuff like that. So.
Yeah, but I don't want to see Alabama anywhere near this playoff.
I don't want to see them in it either, so I'm hoping it kind of goes the way I was saying.
Yeah.
Andrew, Ryan Adey, first off, thanks for the podcast. I appreciate the unbiased takes on the Pac-12, no matter how bad the entire conference is. Unless you're a UCLA fan, Dave really hates UCLA.
I get so much of that. Like, just UCLA fans who are like, why do you hate UCLA so much?
It's like you went there. Like, that's what you do.
It's a mixture of self-loathing and so many other things.
He said, by the time you're reading this, Mike Leach may already be the head coach of Tennessee. After learning from the Chip Kelly drama, I will wait for an official announcement. Anyway, to my questions. Have you ever seen a player regress as much as Luke Falk did this year? Especially on the road, he just wasn't the same guy.
I was trying to think of this. I can't remember. Statistically, it's not going to look like it, but watching him this year, he looked like a fundamentally different quarterback.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever seen a quarterback regress as much as he has. I think other players at different positions based off injuries and other stuff, it can happen, but quarterback play, yeah, this was about as bad as I've seen.
And, you know, he still sets all the records for the Pac-12. I mean, he pretty much owns them all. So while Washington State has had pretty good teams the last 5 years, in the last five Apple Cups, the Mike Leach-led Cougars have been outscored 189-71 and never had a chance at any one of those games. In your opinion, what is the biggest reason for this discrepancy, especially this year where UW was not a very good team?
I mean, I think a big part of it is Chris Peterson, especially through the last three matchups, he seems to have a handle on the air raid. Like, they seem to have had that thing scouted out and pretty much well covered each of the last 3 years. Maybe some of that was Luke Falk, but Luke Falk was really good up until this year. So I think Chris Peterson maybe just has a good feel for what Mike Leach is trying to do offensively, and Leach doesn't really change it up all that much. I mean, it's the same scheme, and it's a good scheme. I mean, it works, but it's the same scheme, and I think Chris Peterson's just kind of well-equipped to handle it. But, yeah, that's my only real explanation. I think the rest of it's just – maybe Washington State just has better talent, better athletes. I mean, Washington has better talent, better athletes.
Yeah.
Washington State, I think from a scheme perspective, had an advantage until Peterson arrived. But yeah, I don't have a great answer. I think it might just be Peterson having a little bit of an advantage over that offense.
Yeah, sometimes it's just guys match up, you know, certain programs match up better against others. And, you know, if you watch, they really did rush three guys a lot and drop dudes back into coverage. And they felt that, you know, Washington State wasn't going to run the ball. They couldn't take advantage of it. You know, if they're doing that a lot, I'm not sure why Washington State wouldn't be running the football more and changing it up a little bit. But they didn't. And I think maybe Chris Peterson took advantage of that. He said a very sad go Cougs. So that was from Andrew. Should we do another voicemail?
Yeah, let's jump into another voicemail.
I know Nick is next, but we'll do a voicemail first. Here we go.
Hey, guys. It's Anthony from Santa Monica. Love the podcast. I'm going to try to keep this a little short because I'm about to send you a lot of numbers. So I grew up in a UCLA household, but I went to USC. So I followed both teams pretty closely for like 15 years. With Jim Moore getting fired and the potential that someone like Chip Kelly could be the next coach, the same refrain seems to pop up again. Can UCLA hire the coach that will wake the sleeping giant, take advantage of the big market and fertile recruiting ground, and turn UCLA into a national power? Seems to happen every time a UCLA coach gets fired, and it looked like Jim Mora might actually be able to do it for a few years. But more on him in a second. For all the talk about what UCLA can or should be, here's some context. UCLA hasn't won a national title since 1954, a Rose Bowl since 1986, a conference title since 1998, and they're 4-15 in the last 19 games against USC. Since the last conference title, they finished in the top 25 three times, but under 500 seven times, and it could be eight this year. Their only real Heisman candidates since Gary Beavin won in 67 have been Troy Aikman and Cade McNown. Remember him? With all that as background, we come to Jim Mora. In his first three seasons, he led UCLA to 29 wins. That's the most wins in any three-year stretch in UCLA football history. It's like sixth or seventh best in winning percentage. And they came out of that with just one division title. Fun fact, Clay Helton has made more Pac-12 title games than Jim Mora. I'll end with this. Jim Mora's winning percentage at UCLA was 605. UCLA's all-time winning percentage is around 580 or 590, depending on the source. My question is, in the three-year stretch where they won 29 games, was that Jim Mora's ceiling as a coach or UCLA's ceiling as a program? Thanks and fight on.
Wow. That was
interesting.
That was numbers.
Well researched. Yeah. I actually did a lot of that research myself, and I would say a lot of it is kind of, I don't want to say unfairly weighted, but a lot of it is weighted by Dan Guerrero's time at UCLA, where the program has basically fallen to, I mean, a little bit above 500 with each of his hires. Carl Durrell was like a, I don't know, something like a 56% winning percentage. Rick Neuheisel was something like a, I mean, 40% winning percentage. He was 21-30 in his time at UCLA. And then Jim Mora finished at, I don't know, something like 50-30 or I don't know, something like that. But regardless, yeah, I mean, there's definitely a case to be made that UCLA, I mean, is it systemic or is it just they've hired a lot of bad coaches? I'm more of the opinion they've hired a lot of bad coaches and they've revered a coach who is like, I mean, his whole career is based off of going like 7-4 as an average record in Terry Donahue. But if you go back, I mean, the potential for UCLA, I mean, in terms of recruiting, in terms of all that stuff, if they have an elite on-field coach, I think is pretty strong. I mean, if you go back to when UCLA was actually really good, not just like kind of the fake good under Terry Donahue, where they won some conferences, won some Rose Bowls, but never really seriously competed for a national championship. If you go back to like, and yeah, we're going back 60, 70 years now, but if we go back to Red Sanders, if you go back to Tommy Prothrow, even if you go back to, you know, guys like Pepper Rogers or Dick Vermeil, when they had an elite on-field coach, they were very competitive with everybody. You know, Red Sanders had it as one of the best programs in the country in the 50s, and, you know, that's going back a great distance. So is there something systemic wrong with UCLA? I think this is the point at which we'll find out, because I think Jim Mora, for all of his, you know, good qualities those first 3 years, was never an elite on-field coach. There were a lot of complaints with him those first 3 years. And I think, you know, if he stayed committed, if his, you know, off seasons hadn't been spent flirting with NFL teams every single off season, like if he'd just been a little bit of a different guy, but brought the same kind of energy to recruiting, the same energy to staff hires over the course of his tenure, rather than, you know, just over the first couple of years, yeah, maybe it turns out differently. But I think that was more the high point for Mora than it was for the UCLA program as a whole. But we're going to find out. Chip Kelly is that elite on-field coach. And so if, you know, the proof will be in the pudding. If UCLA cannot get it done in the next 4 or 5 years, then you might have a pretty strong point there.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, that's what we were talking about, making the Rose Bowl. Last time UCLA won a Rose Bowl, like, I think you have to
I was 2 months old.
And USC, like the other, you know, the other guy wrote in, you know, you hire like your non-play calling offensive coordinator and won a Rose Bowl with him. Like, it's like when all my buddies that were, it's not a great analogy, but my buddies that are longtime Cubs fans, they were waiting years and years for a World Series, and Florida Marlins go out and win a World Series, blow their team up, go to the crapper, start, and then within a few years we'll come back and win another World Series. You're like, how have the Cubs not been able to do this in over 100 years? You know, USC can kind of like sleepwalk through things and still win Rose Bowls. You got to get, you know, even when they're not doing everything great, they're still like good enough where they can, you know, things can work out and they can win a Rose Bowl. So you got to get back to that where UCLA is competing for the title. They're going to Rose Bowls. They can win a Rose Bowl every once in a while. And you got to be able to do that. And if you can't do it in the next 5 years with Chip Kelly at some point, then yeah, there's probably a systematic problem there somewhere.
Yeah. And let me just say this too. I mean, on the flip side of all of that is UCLA just got finished hiring Bob Toledo, who was an offensive coordinator no one else was considering, Carl Durrell, a wide receivers coach who no one else was considering, Rick Neuheisel, who was like just on the scrap heap of coaching, and then Jim Mora, who was fired after a single season with the Seattle Seahawks and, you know, 4 seasons with the Atlanta Falcons, where he never did anything of note and never coached in college before. And they still won like 60% of their games. I think that speaks to the recruiting potential for UCLA. Yeah. That even with these, I mean, Mora wasn't a joke of a coach, and maybe neither was Toledo, except, I mean, aside from those first 3 years, he was pretty bad. But Durrell and Neuheisel, I mean, the fact that the program isn't completely destroyed, like Tennessee-level destroyed, I think speaks to the recruiting base for UCLA, that, you know, even, you know, going through 9 years of those guys, they were still able to sustain enough of a talent base to then be able to give Mora, who's a goodish coach but not a great one, the tools to win 9 games, 10 games, and then 10 games. So I tend to think the potential is there. I think there's enough evidence there that the potential is there as long as the coaching part is figured out.
Yeah.
And they just haven't figured it out for the last, like, 4 hires.
That's why it's going to be so interesting. You want to read Nick's?
Yeah. Rundown and questions. Hi, this is Nick from Cyprus, a.k.a. Big Nick, 21, USC from the P. Cal 27 versus UCLA 30. So the big news is Chip Kelly to UCLA, but they got bowl eligible to get that sixth win. Cal came up short from bowl eligible. To me, Cal finished better than expected. UCLA finished at par, in my opinion. U of A 30 versus ASU 42. Wow, both teams get 7 wins on the regular season. Both overachieved, and both coaches will probably keep their jobs. Nope. And maybe an extension. K-Tate has to be Offensive Player of the Year. ASU won the Territorial Cup. U of A kind of fell short last 2 weeks, in my opinion. Garbage, parentheses, OSU 10 versus Oregon 69. This is a complete ass-whooping. Didn't watch the game, but it's irrelevant when you win by almost 60. You owned the game from beginning to end. Oregon played well, getting that 7th win. OSU was garbage. I called this early. They would go 1-11 and 0-9 in conference.
Good job,
Nick. Great job, Nick. Washington 14, UW 41. UW owned this game by D. Didn't have to pass the ball. Washington State came up short. UW wins 10 but won't rep the North. Washington State won 9 games, which is good. Both lived up to standard. Notre Dame 20 versus Stanford 38. Stanford won and killed any chance ND makes the playoffs. Stanford got 9 wins, which is a solid considering the slow start versus USC and San Diego State. Colorado 13 versus Utah 34. Utah is bowl eligible. Colorado was a disappointment in this game and season. Utah won but didn't live up to the hype. But Utah will go bowling. Questions. Which team was the biggest surprise, letdown, and kind of hard to read? For him, it was Oregon State being the disappointment. The surprise was U of A, and hard to read was UW.
I'd say, OSU definitely disappointment. Didn't expect them to not have their coach and didn't expect them to be 1-11. A U of A surprise, I think them, or even ASU. Like, they're picked 5th and 6th in the Pac-12 South. But I'd say hard to read would be Colorado because they were, you kind of thought that the defense would take a step back and the offense would be really good. Some weeks they were, some weeks, it just was all over the place.
Yeah, and I didn't see them, I just didn't see, like, and I don't mean to, like, denigrate, but I didn't see them playing that hard. Like, it just didn't seem like it was the same vibe around that team this year. And so that was, I mean, I think I picked them to go 5-7 or 6-6.
Yeah.
I'm remembering that now.
I think you did.
But it wasn't the way I thought it was going to happen. I thought their defense would just be so bad, like, just so unable to do anything, and their offense would be pretty good. And it was, it's a tough Pac-12. But I just didn't see a really well-coached, cohesive team this year. All right, who wins the conference championship game? I picked Stanford. I don't think you picked a winner.
I didn't pick a winner. I kind of still think USC wins the game for some reason, but, I'm going to take those points. So Nick's picking USC.
All right, name your players of the year, offense, defense, special teams, and coach of the year.
Oh, geez. Who do you think offense should be?
I'm going to go K-Tate.
Yeah.
Just because it was so much fun. Obviously, it didn't end the year quite as explosively as he was in the middle stretch, but he almost single-handedly made this a watchable Arizona team. So I'm going to go K-Tate for offense.
I'll probably take Love. I'll take Love for...
That seems fine, too. Defense, I'm going to go Hercules Mataafa. I thought he was really good.
Vita Vey or whatever for Washington, like maybe him. But I think Hercules would be, be my pick. Just because he's
undersized. Special teams, obviously Dante Pettis, right?
Pettis said, he had like 8 punt returns for touchdowns, so we'll go with him.
Yeah.
Coach of the year, Todd Graham for me. What do you think?
Honestly, that's justified. That's completely justified. It was a good coaching year from him. I wouldn't give it to Rich Rod because I don't know how much that was Rich Rod and how much it was just Cleo Tate. I think I would go Graham. I mean, I think that was the job of the year. Getting that team to 2nd in the South, it was no joke. So nice little exit present for Todd Graham.
I wouldn't do as much on Rich Rod because he had Cleo Tate and didn't start him anyway, and Tate wasn't in there, it's like, is that really coaching or is that just you had a really good quarterback,
Yeah.
But we'll see. Let's see. So we still have like 11 questions left, and I have like, I really should be going in about 15 minutes or so. So we'll try to go through these quickly, I guess.
Yeah.
Frank said, is Baker Mayfield just a high priced version of Johnny Manziel, Frank in Sacramento? There's a lot of similarities there. There are. I mean, I think Baker Mayfield's a better quarterback, but some of those antics, man, like, I want to read the bylaws for the Heisman thing. Like, would I vote Bryce Love ahead of him on the Heisman because of the off the field stuff? I think character and stuff comes into that. I'm going to read through all that stuff before I vote, but some of that stuff just really turns me off. I don't know about you, Dave.
Completely. And I think it speaks to somebody who's immature emotionally and has some real maturity issues. And that's Johnny Manziel. And I know there's a bunch of people saying, oh, but he's a much better prospect and all this other stuff. And I think for whatever reason, people like him personally, but that kind of stuff on the field is weird. Like, it's weird stuff that you don't see from other players. And the reason you don't see it from other players is because it's weird. It's, you know, something that's going on there that's not quite right. I think he's got some maturity issues that he's going to have to figure out. And if you're not mature in a, you know, a league like the NFL, you're going to have some real issues. So yeah, I 100% think he's a high priced version of Johnny Manziel.
Okay.
All right. John, Pac-12 woes. Hi, Dave and Ryan. Now that Chip Kelly is at UCLA, the executives at Fox and ESPN must be giddy thinking about having UCLA and Chip Kelly drawing viewers, including two Friday night games in 2018. How bad does Uncle Larry's TV deal look now? Do you think the folks at UCLA that spent the money to get Chip are ready to join forces with USC to try to make changes to the Pac-12 revenue distribution, or are both LA schools stuck until the current deal runs out 5 years from now? I think they're stuck, but that's just my pessimistic take.
I think they're stuck too, but I think, you know, there's enough. If we do, we talked about this before. If you see more presidents kind of bitching about stuff, then you can actually get some change. That's what it really needs to be, you know. The presidents have to do it. Like, I think a lot of the athletic directors are upset about it. But until the presidents are, I don't think you're going to see much change there. And they locked in that 12-year deal that everyone loved in the beginning. But by now, and it's going to get worse because the other, you know, when Rutgers and Iowa State and teams like that are making $20 million more than like UCLA and Washington and stuff, like, yeah, that's probably a problem.
Yep.
Alex says, this is Alex from Pasadena. He said, so, how was your weekend? Anything interesting happened? Pretty chill weekend, right? Okay, on to the question. With Christmas coming, if you had one gift to give each of the bottom two teams in your Pac-12 rankings, one gift each, what would it be? Thanks, Alex from Pasadena. By the way, chip, chip, hooray! I think Alex is probably like a Washington State fan, you think? Or is that...
I think maybe like a Utah fan. So one gift to each of Oregon State and who was it? Colorado?
Colorado, yeah.
Oregon State, I would give the gift of decisiveness in hiring Bo Baldwin because I think he'll be really good there.
I like that. I would give them the clairvoyance to know that they need to do something different. So maybe go hire somebody that runs like the Veer or something. Just, you got to do something different. Yeah. It's just not working.
Go hire Troy Calhoun or something.
Yeah, something like different. That. Yeah.
For Colorado, boy.
I'm going to give no does. Like they need to wake up. Like they just, like Dave was saying, they just didn't. They looked like, it just didn't look like they were into it the whole time. I know they lost a lot of senior leadership off that defense, but man, they just seemed like they didn't show up all the time. So a little no-dos, a little peppy, you know, maybe some Monster energy drink or something.
I like that. I like that. They need a little bit of Monster in their lives going into next year. A little bit of Red Bull.
I like that. Right?
Okay. Yeah.
Any sponsors out there? If you guys want to sponsor us, if you work for Monster or something.
All right. Is it me next or you?
I think it's you.
Okay, coaching carousel questions. This is from Scott in Washington. Ryan and Dave, thanks for a great season of podcasts. Look forward to listening to them every Monday after getting home from work. A couple of coaching questions. Mike Leach has a very unique personality. With Tennessee, Arkansas, and Texas A&M all currently having job openings, could you see one of those programs taking a chance on him, and do you see his system working in the SEC? Washington has showed him the last 4 years in the Apple Cup what can be done to it when you have Sunday-type defensive linemen. This year is Vita Vea, great gains that can get pressure from just having to rush three or four. Down there, he's going to see 4 to 6 teams in conference games that have those level of dudes or better every season. Okay, first question. I agree with you. I don't think he's a fit in the SEC. I think there are just too many good defensive linemen.
Yeah, I would agree there. And I think just, you know, he's so weird and quirky. Like, the fan base, if you saw, you know, what happened with Vault Twitter and everything on Sunday, you know, he's going to be talking, instead of talking about grandma and church, he's talking about Pocahontas or whatever. You know, he's talking to some, you know, Civil War battle or something. Well, maybe that's not a good analogy, but something that just out of, you know, he'll talk something like Pacific War from World War II, and they're like, what are you talking about? You know, we want sweet tea and chicken and dumplings and stuff. So I just don't think it would be a great fit in the SEC for him.
Yep. And then second question, Todd Graham out at ASU, rumor has Kevin Sumlin coming there. If I'm a Sun Devil fan, sell me that we're just not trading one coach who can take us to a certain level for another. I cannot sell you on that because I think Kevin Sumlin and Todd Graham are the exact same thing. A good-ish coach who will be, you know, he'll have his peak year where he gets you to 10-2, competes for the conference, and then he's going to have a pretty good year that's like an 8-5, and then he's going to have a couple of lull years where it's going to be a bowl, you know, bowl, maybe not a bowl, and then it'll peak back up. I think, you know, you're getting goodish coaches at that point, unless you have a line on an elite coach. I think if I'm ASU at this point, I probably take a flyer, unless I can have unless I have some sort of in with some super elite coach that we don't know about. I'd probably take a flyer on a younger guy and hope you strike gold at this point. But I thought firing Todd Graham was stupid. I think it's a dumb move.
I'm a little more bullish on Kevin Sumlin. I mean, he took some really good players out of Arizona. I think he could recruit.
And did what with them?
Yeah.
And did what with them?
Had fun with them. They, like, scored a bunch of touchdowns. I don't know. Plus, he likes to party, I hear. And, you know, Millaf would be really good for him. No, I think he'd be good. I think he would recruit better. I think keep some of those kids home and go out and get some dudes. And, you know, having a youngish, kind of fun African-American coach, I don't think that hurts at all. I kind of think he would do good things there, but, you know, that's the sleeping really tall guy or sleeping giant, depending on who you talk to. I think that would be a big splash hire. And if you're talking about bringing in Chip Kelly and bringing in Kevin Sumlin, that just makes the Pac-12 all that much more interesting to me. So I'm a little more bullish on him than Dave is, I guess.
Yeah, way more.
Way more. Okay. You're just a pessimistic guy, you know.
I'm a pessimistic fella.
Yeah. But that was Scott in Washington, go Dogs. Thanks, Scott. Should I play a voicemail before we do the one last voicemail?
All right, let's do it.
Let's do it. Okay.
Hey, guys. Love your show. I might be your one fan from Arkansas. My name is Joshua here in Western Arkansas. And dadgum, Chip Kelly beat me to the punch. But I had a suggestion for UCLA's next head coach. And my suggestion would be Snoop Dogg. Now, I know what you're saying. There's a lot of obstacles there. One, he's a big-time USC fan. Two, he's got a game show. Other than that, I don't see a problem with him because we already know he is an amazing youth football coach. He gets all the best talent. He coached John Ross. How could he not just kill it in recruiting? I don't understand. Everybody would want to come play for Snoop Dogg. Number two, think about the hype videos that would come out before the games. I mean, nobody could compete with that. I think Snoop Dogg should have been the next coach, and I think he'd be an amazing college football coach. I just wanted to get with y'all's thoughts on that because I think I'm onto a brilliant genius idea here, and somebody needs to jump on this.
Josh from Arkansas.
My favorite part of that was, like, the kid in the background.
All right, I gotta give him applause, my bad.
Yeah, that was great. My favorite part of that was, like, the kid in the background who was, like, making noise back there. It was just great. Well, he was firing off that voicemail. Yeah, and an interesting piece there is that Snoop Dogg's kid was at UCLA, Cordell Broaddus.
Yeah.
So there's a connection there. I think it's flawless. I think they should actually back out of the Chip Kelly deal right now and make this happen. I think it's a can't miss. It's a can't-miss opportunity.
I mean, it's like, what if someone did that? Like, what if Tennessee is like, screw it. We can't get, like, some big coach. Snoop Dogg, you're our coach. Like, how badass would that be? Like, that you would be the talk of college football. You just hire some other coaches and stuff to do, like, the regular crap. And then you have Snoop Dogg as your coach. Like, I think that's brilliant.
Yeah. All right, should we wrap?
He's the coolest guy on the planet.
Oh, for sure. Should we rapid fire a couple? You have time?
Yeah, yeah. So let's do. So Tom says, Ryan and Dave, love the podcast. Appreciate the Pac-12 insight that comes every week. Now that Colorado's season wrapped up by getting run over by Utah, they wrapped up 7-5, a drop off of 5 wins from last year, which is very frustrating.
5-7.
I'm sorry.
Five and seven.
My bad. Drop off of 5 wins from last year, which is very frustrating. I wasn't expecting back-to-back 10 wins, but sure was expecting a second consecutive bowl appearance, which hasn't happened since the 2004-2005 seasons. As someone who sees Colorado from the outside, what do you see as realistic expectations for Colorado on a year-to-year basis? I can't fathom that it's the decade plus of losing plus 10-2 seems like an aberration as well. Facilities have been upgraded, but after the way the season finished, I'm not sure we have the right coach there either. Thanks, Tom, in Fort Myers, Florida. Man, we're getting all kinds of people from all over the place.
Yeah. I mean, I think Colorado's a good program. Like, I think it should be. Like, I think there's, I mean, I think there's potential there to be really good. I think they had a really, really long stretch of ugly, kicked off by my buddy, Rick Neuheisel, and then continued by Gary Barnett and Dan Dawkins. Well, Gary Barnett actually was doing some nice things, but then Dan Hawkins did nothing good. But, I mean, I think there's potential there. I think it's like, I don't see any reason why they can't be like what we've talked about with ASU, where a team that competes for the conference once every 3 or 4 years and then is consistently at, you know, more or less a minimum of a bowl team. Yeah, they'll have the occasional year where they're 4-8 or 5-7, but consistently being a bowl team, consistently, you know, every 3 or 4 years having a run at a conference championship, I don't know why that's out of the question for Colorado. It doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, they won a national championship in, you know, some of our memories, you know, so it's like it's been there. I think it was one of those things where last year was probably a little bit of an overachievement and you'd rather have gone like maybe, you know, 8-4 last year and 7-5 this year, as opposed to like 10-2 and then 5-7, you know, making back-to-back bowl games, maybe more important than, but you know, getting 10 wins was really important too. So, but it's, you kind of felt like maybe last year was a little bit overachieving and then this year certainly felt like they were underachieving.
Yeah. All right, so this is from Bobby. Help from Sun Devil Land. I don't even know where to begin here. I think most fans understand what ASU is and realize that you can't just be in Alabama or USC without the tradition, fan support, and most importantly, money. Ray Anderson is not most fans. I think I called him Ray Davidson earlier. It's Ray Anderson.
Oh, yeah.
Whatever. If you took a poll on Sun Devil Source, you'd see that around 80% or more of fans wanted to keep Graham for at least another year. In fact, if you are a member of the Scout 247 network anywhere, I've discovered that you can read any board for free without the ability to post. Check out Sun Devil Source and see how much people hate this. This whole thing just seems weird to me. Whenever we fired a coach in the past, it always felt like it came a little bit too late. This one seems like it's a lot too early, especially considering Todd Graham finally gave up the defense this year with at least some improvement to show for it, as well as a positive trajectory with a lot of returning talent next year. Hope David targets his criticisms more on the AD than ASU itself, because I don't think the fans that make up ASU are really excited about the coaching search and would have preferred to just see if Graham could get back to 10 wins in the next season or two. Thanks, guys. It's been a great season. Go Devils. P.S. If we end up with Rumlin, I might have to start picketing. All right. Good take from Bobby.
Yeah, I think I, and just for a note, if you're an annual subscriber on 247, you can read the other premium boards, but that's going to change, I think, at some point. And then if you're like a super VIP, I forget what they call it, but it's like it's the highest VIP thing, then you can read them all. I don't know, but they're changing all that kind of stuff. But for now, you should be able to read the other ones as long as you're an annual member.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think he could have been the coach of the year. So I think we agree there. I'm not going to say the SU fans are delusional there. I think that they probably got it right. Now, if they go get a home run guy, you know, we'll see. But, like, yeah, without that, like Dave said, without a home run dude, I'm not sure this was the right move.
Yeah, 100%.
Matt in Hyde Park, Chicago. Good men of the Podcast of Champions. I think that's how Matt would say it.
Uh-huh, now, absolutely.
Now that Todd Graham has been fired, I'm left to wonder what the exact moment when Ray Anderson decided it was time to let him go. He may have held on to the position through the end of the regular season, but given the fact he closed out the year with back-to-back wins, one against hated U of E, and finished with a winning record, it's clear Anderson had fired him in his mind well before that. Here are the four most obvious choices. Feel free to offer a fifth or sixth as you prefer. So these are when he feels Ray Anderson decided to fire him. One, after ASU lost at home to San Diego State, the first such loss for a Pac-12 team at home against the Aztecs. Two, after ASU was blown out at home by USC and essentially knocked out of the South Division title race. Three, after ASU squandered a 14-point lead at UCLA, ensuring an 0-2 showing against the LA schools and another trip to a second-tier bowl. Four, after UCLA hired Chip Kelly. And one final question, how delusional is Ray Anderson for saying that ASU should be a quote-unquote top three program in the Pac-12? Is he Charlie Weiss, quote-unquote, schematic advantage delusional, or just Butch Jones, quote-unquote, champions of life delusional? Well, that's a great question, too.
That's so good. All right, I'd go after number two. I think it was after ASU was, judging by what he said in the press conference,
yeah.
I think it was after being blown out at home by USC and being knocked out of the South Division title race.
Yeah, because because they finished second in the South, but he didn't seem to care because that was a key game. And that was coming off the big win against Washington, so... And literally, let's like USC's the second best USC looked all year. So,
yeah, and then it's more Charlie Weiss schematic advantage delusional for me. I mean, top three program in the Pac-12. Honestly, that was the less delusional part. He also said he wanted to be a top 15 program nationally, year in and year out. Do you know, like, top 15 program, like teams that are consistently ranked in the top 15 at the end of the year? Like, there isn't a Pac-12 school on that list. USC should be if they actually got their coaching situation figured out ever. But, I mean, even they haven't really been the last 10 years. I mean, the schools that are like that are Alabama, Ohio State, and then maybe, like, Clemson lately. But even still, like, being a top 15 team nationally is, like, even more delusional than top three in the Pac-12, which is delusional as well.
Yeah. Good question, though, yeah.
All right. Can we do more? We got two more.
Yeah,
let's wrap it up.
I'll just be late for practice, you know, whatever. I'm already
late.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah.
All right, this is from Matthew. Hey, Ryan and Dave, one of the most interesting times of the year has begun. Chip Kelly is the home run hire SC should have made 2 years ago. Good for the Bruins. I see this as a positive for SC because it's going to force Lynn Swann's hand for coaching upgrades sooner rather than later, despite the impressive win percentage the last 2 years. Depending on who Arizona State hires, USC may have the fifth, sixth worst coaching staff in the Pac-12 South in a heartbeat. I think you might be getting a little pessimistic there, but maybe. This brings me to my question about the Pac-12 in general for you guys. I've always heard programs in the conference referred to as sleeping giants, Arizona State, UCLA, Colorado, but have never seen it in reality. Is this just hyperbole on the parts of fans, media, or is it an actual possibility? Could the conference ever be as deep and competitive at the top to match the SEC Big Ten? Seems to me there are too many monetary, fan support, recruiting limitations for this to ever happen. I would like to hear your opinions on what the floor ceiling is for each program in the conference. USC floor is 5-7, and ceiling is national championship. Love the show. Helps my work commute fly by.
Nice.
All right, let's rapid fire it. You ready for it?
Dave, well, I think it's pronounced hyperbole. Okay. Sorry. I'm sorry.
Washington. Ceiling is national championship.
Yes.
Floor is 0-12.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we've seen that not that long ago, so we have to do that.
Realistic floor, I don't think in the Chris Peterson era they're ever going to win fewer than six games. I think in a very bad year, maybe the year after, you know, Gaskin and all these guys on offense graduate, maybe 6-6.
Yeah.
But I think that's the absolute floor for Peterson's program. Leach at Washington State. I think ceiling is Pac-12 championship.
Yeah, I would say that. I would say Pac-12 championship. I don't see them winning a national championship, and floor is probably like a 5-7 or something. I
could see them being worse because I think people are starting to figure out that offense. But, yeah, I think floor is somewhere in the 4-8, 5-7 range. Oregon, ceiling, I think I'm going to say it's still national championship, but I don't know if out of the Chip Kelly – Mark Helfrich era, if that's going to happen again soon, but I think it's still a national championship.
But they were in the championship game not that long ago, so we'll have to say that, yeah.
Yeah, and then floor is obviously pretty low.
They were 4-8 last year, so they were like, you know.
I mean, basically what we're going to get through here is that there are a lot of teams here with national championship potential, right? Let's just go through it. I mean, the schools with national championship potential, like realistic national championship potential, are Washington, Oregon, Stanford, USC, Are we giving it to UCLA?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's, I mean, obviously it's a long way to go, but I think there's, you know, I think a lot of this has to do with the coaches too. Like, would you have been saying this about Stanford 15 years ago, but you got Harbaugh and Shaw, and it's like, hey, they're making Rose Bowls. They're doing, you know, winning the title. Like that, now they got it, you know. It's like, so could UCLA do that? Could ASU do that? Could Colorado do that? You know, if they get their David Shaw or they get their Chris Peterson, then I think they can. Like, there's, because we've seen some high level success from those programs, you could get back there.
Yeah. And so I guess to answer your question, every school in this conference, if they get the right mix, has a ceiling of a national championship. I mean,
I don't know about Oregon, everyone.
Well, Oregon 25 years ago, would anybody have thought Oregon was going to be what it was under Chip Kelly?
Yeah.
I mean, if you build it right, I mean, I think it can happen. It just takes time and energy and commitment and program and a lot of other stuff. But the reason why you see, going back to it, the reason why you see Sleeping Giants, I've seen it a little bit with ASU. I haven't seen it as much with Colorado. With UCLA, I could speak to that one. It's because UCLA consistently recruits at like a top 15, top 20 level. Like, the fact that they have that recruiting base and are still so bad every year makes people think, oh, well, if they actually got a real coach for once, they would probably be pretty good. So that's what goes into that. With Arizona State, I think it's a lesser level of that. And they now have facilities that make them really competitive. I haven't heard it as much with Colorado, though.
Yeah, not as much with them. But, you know, because they have won, you know, a championship and they, you know, whatever. But it's I think coaching can make the big difference here. We'll see who ASU brings in. We'll see what Oregon State does. They might change things up and have like a crazy system that you got to prepare for every week or, you know, every time you play them. So I think it'll be interesting. But I think that's our last one, Dave.
That was our last one.
Nice. Thanks for all the questions. I mean, so many. That was good. The voice. I'm glad. I'm never going to listen to voicemails ahead of time again. They were all really good.
Don't say that.
Okay.
We're seriously going to get something really vile now. It's going to be great.
Nice. All right. Well, we better wrap it up because I got to go get to, you know, the football practice thing. It's been. I had a bye week last week, Dave, so I didn't have to go to practice.
I know. You're out of rhythm. You're out of rhythm.
Yeah.
You're a little rusty yourself.
I am. A little bit.
Your timing's off.
But that's David Woods. I am Ryan Abraham. Thank you so much. We are the Podcast of Champions. We really appreciate you listening and calling in and emailing us and tweeting us and all that fun stuff. And we will talk to you next time right after the Pac-12 championship game. We'll let you know who won and talk about what's going to go forward for the Pac-12 at that point. Thanks for tuning in.